Hello, and welcome to Nostalgia Marcana. I'm your host, Doug Leaf. Each episode of this podcast, we'll look back on the movies, TV, games, people, and phenomena that we still love talking about all these years later, and ask ourselves why these bits of pop culture still enchant us today. This week, we'll be revisiting... In Alfred Hitchcock's classic North by Northwest, dapper Cary Grant is mistaken for a spy and unwittingly drawn into a world of intrigue and espionage. Now replace Cary Grant with chronic underachiever Jeffrey Lebowski, a.k.a. The Dude, and you have today's subject, The Big Lebowski. I'm really excited to dig into this Coen Brothers classic. I'll just put it out right here. I think this is my favorite Coen Brothers movie. It's eminently quotable. It is incredibly fun to watch. And no matter how many times you watch it, you always find something new. So I think we're going to have a good time digging into this one today. But I'm not doing it alone. I have my full bowling team here to do it with me. First, he has been on many of our prior podcasts. He's also my prior podcasting partner from our old show, A Podcast But Evil. Please welcome back Dan Oster.
Thank you very much, Doug. It's good to be here.
And I can pretty much guarantee you will be hearing both your Jeff Bridges and my bastardized version of your Jeff Bridges.
So when I first heard you doing it, I was like, he's doing my Jeff Bridges. We can get into that if you want. Where that came from. Like most impressions, I accidentally started to sound like him. I mean, I might as well just say it now really quickly. I was just pulling out of a driveway and this lady cut me off and she had this little dog like sitting on her lap while she was driving. And my windows were up. I didn't like yell at her, but to myself, I was like, you have a dog on your lap. Like, that's how I said it. I was like, hey, that kind of sounds like Jeff Bridges. So it's kind of funny how that happened.
Yeah. And like I said, I'm pretty sure you're going to hear both of them tonight. And of course, our other guest you've heard on many of our prior episodes on a lot of musical groups. So he's been on our episodes on Queen and most recently Led Zeppelin. But he is a very talented comedy writer and performer as well. So I'm really glad we have him on to talk about something other than music this time. Please welcome back to the show, Lost Moon Radio's Dylan Riss.
Over the line, market foul. Market foul, dude.
We're set. We got everybody here.
Throwing rocks tonight.
Yeah, exactly. Damn it.
Right. Damn it. Oh, no.
All right. I'll start off this podcast the way we always do by talking about our nostalgic memories. So, Dylan, this podcast actually came together because the three of us and some friends, another friend of the podcast, and of course, Amy, my wife, we all play these Jackbox games fairly regularly. We have these online game nights. And we were playing one of these games, and the prompt that the game spat out was something like, name a movie you could watch over and over and over for the rest of your life, and your answer was The Big Lebowski, which is why I thought, oh, great, let's do this. So tell me why that is for you. Tell me about your memories of the movie and why you hold it so dear.
Well, yeah, it's hard to think of a movie that rewards repeat viewing more than The Big Lebowski. So I don't even know if I can really remember the first time I saw it that much, because I think it was the time I enjoyed it the least, you know, which is not to say I didn't like it. I liked it. But this is definitely a movie where it's like, you know, assuming that you're a Coen Brothers type of fan, but assuming that's your cinematic taste. The cool thing about the movie is you'll like it the first time, and it will literally be your least favorite time watching the movie because it just keeps getting better. I did not see it in theaters. I do know that. I first saw it, you know, when it was released on whether that was VHS or DVD, because it was still in the 90s. Might have been a VHS they first saw it on.
What's a DVD? Just,
yeah, exactly. Exactly. So it's like a VHS, Dan, but it's not retro.
Oh, okay. Not cool.
So yeah, not cool.
Not yet. Give it a few more years.
Exactly. Then it'll be the cool retro thing. Anyway, so, you know, just seen it many times over the years, but I think the funny thing about it is that for me, that first time was probably the least distinct time I watched it, just because it keeps getting better.
Dan, how about you? How about your nostalgic memories of The Big Lebowski?
Well, you know, my friends in high school and I, like, one of the things we really loved were movies. And I know that we would go to midnight movies pretty much every weekend in Westwood near UCLA, where you were going to be attending college. Probably not yet then. But I'm sure Big Lebowski was one of them. I don't know if it was the first time I saw it, but I do know that, like, we had a heavy fandom of the things that we liked. And certainly, you know, The Big Lebowski was one of those things. I was just thinking about what Dylan was saying about, it is absolutely the quintessential, like, film that you have to see more than once. That's why it didn't do well when it first came out, but now is a cult classic. It's a lot of the most blank things. It's one of the best LA movies. It's such a great movie about Los Angeles culture. And, you know, just Los Angeles as a location. So if someone never didn't live here and, like, wanted to know what it was like to live here, I'd probably show them this movie and be like, this is kind of close, you know, just like all the little details, like his landlord having the one man performance or whatever that he goes and sees, and just weird stuff like that. So it's just great, like, LA movie. I mean, I don't know. It's just, it's also weirdly a time capsule. Like, what year did it come out?
1998,
but doesn't it take place like it's supposed to take place like a few years before 98, just for some reason?
During the first Gulf War.
Yeah, it's just fun little stuff like that throughout. So it is, I don't know if I remember seeing it the first time, but every time you watch it, you find new things to like about it. And that is absolutely true.
Yeah, it's also a great noir movie, even though it's sort of an Inside Out noir movie, because it's, you know, he's not trying to solve the case to solve it. He's basically trying to solve the case to get out of it. You know, he's the schmo who's stuck in the middle of things. But, like, it is, there's so much about it that nods towards stuff like Chinatown, you know, which is another quintessential LA noir movie, but in its own weird, like, way. And I know the Coen brothers set out to make a noir movie, and they had just come off of doing Fargo, which is also sort of a similar idea of, like, you know, simple crime plan spins out of control. This is, you know, and Fargo is funny, but also pretty harrowing in parts. This is just pure comedy. And I remember seeing this, I'm pretty sure this was the first Coen Brothers movie I saw. And I saw it in my freshman year of college. I remember going to see it in Westwood at the theater. So for all I know, we could have been seeing it at the same time. And just huge belly laughs coming out of the theater. Like, I know it didn't do amazingly well for one of the Coen Brothers movies at the time, but you wouldn't have known that from the audience reaction that night. Like, it was, you know, they were killing. And I can't think of a movie with better character work than this. Like, Jeff Bridges as the dude and John Goodman as Walter Sobchak, like, they embody those characters to an impossible degree that is just flabbergasting as an acting performance.
Well, you can just tell that they love what they're doing. I mean, you know, Jeff Bridges is probably closer to Jeff Lebowski than John Goodman is to Walter Sobchak, you know, in terms of their actual personas. But you can tell that they're just loving the hell out of what they're doing, which is always, I think, an important part of any kind of comedy, you know, is that they're embodying the characters. They're not winking at the camera, but you can tell that they're having the time of their life.
Yeah. Well, that, off of both of your points, I mean, I think they're having a great time sending up films that they love, classic films. And, you know, here's my big contribution to this podcast is, you know, the biggest reference is the film The Big Sleep, which it takes its
right
name from. If you haven't watched those two film movies back to back, watch The Big Sleep and then watch The Big Lebowski, you'll be like,
Sleep might make even less sense than The Big Lebowski.
Yes, that's true. It's definitely, you know, there's some weird stuff in there, but there's some shot for shot homages to it, and some key elements, including a wheelchair bound millionaire whose daughter's involved in pornography, and just, you know, casting the dude based on somebody who they really knew in real life and putting him in the Philip Marlowe role, I think kind of just amused them to no end. And yeah, it's like, what if our stoner buddy was, you know, the Philip Marlowe role in a film noir?
Well, the Coen brothers have always been good about that. Like, they experiment every time they do a movie, they're always trying something. And it often, in their best work, is more than the sum of its parts. Like, you can imagine somebody doing that pitch of like a film noir with a, you know, old stoner as the protagonist, and you could tell that that was what was happening. You could get the joke from the very beginning, and it would all be very kind of predictable. And, you know, but this is like, that's just one of 20 things going on in this movie. And so that's what makes it sort of more of a dense work, is like, yes, you can analyze it on that level, but you can analyze it on a lot of other levels. And I think that, again, you know, Doug saw it in a night where it was doing really well. I could imagine it doing better if it was a little more obvious that that was like what was going on. It just happens to be part of it, you know? Which, again, repeat viewings.
Well, and yeah, well, getting into that point about the repeat viewings is, I think the repeat viewings are rewarding. One, because it's still a mystery, you know, movie. So once you know the ending, you can watch interesting things fall into place on the second viewing. But as a comedy, there's so many jokes in this that are like, they're runners that you don't realize are runners. You know, there's like, I don't know that you would necessarily pick up on the way that the Jeff Bridges repeats things he hears in the world.
It's such a great character trait.
Yeah, this is like, you know, what a dumb person trying to sound smart. So he hears George Bush say this aggression will not stand. And so he repeats it. But it's subtle enough that, like, you don't realize he's doing it like all the way through the movie. There's lots of little just tiny things like that that you're like, oh, that this thing at the beginning of the movie actually gets referenced at the end of the movie in ways that you don't necessarily pick up on right away.
Well, there's master filmmakers, you know. It's just like they are some of the most confident filmmakers out there in terms of like, we're doing this, like, we get it, and you might get it, but we're doing it. Yeah.
And there's a lot of overtly quirky and weird stuff in this movie, like things that are really only in there to be funny. Like, John Turturro's entire character is just like, what if this funny thing happened? Because we thought of this funny idea. He has no relevance to the larger plot. It's just, we just want to do this funny thing.
We're not going
to
talk about the unsanctioned spinoff, are we?
I hope not. I've never seen that.
I thought they gave him his blessing, their blessing.
I mean, maybe it was
the Jesus rolls.
They were not involved anyway. So just to really, you know, just really quickly for those that are curious, and we'll get to that character, I guess, in due course. But the Jesus, yes, John Turturro's character, very recently, it feels like it was maybe even a COVID thing, but like John Turturro went off and made this like spinoff about the character that the Coen brothers are not involved in. And it just, you know, It was as good as it sounds. I mean, from what I could tell, it was just such a strange idea.
Well, they had Noah Hawley come to them and pitch them on an idea. Can I turn Fargo into a TV show? And that really worked. And then I guess he pitched them on, John Turturro pitched them on Jesus' character and didn't work.
Well, it's funny to me that, like, you know, Fargo, I watched the first season. I watched maybe some of the subsequent ones, but like, I can't really remember where I stopped watching it. And, it's enjoyable enough, and it maybe has evolved a little bit over time. But certainly the first season to me, you know, is so clearly like Coen Brothers fan film. Like, you know, it's like a fan film. It's like you take certain elements and you kind of remix it and everything, which is fine. But how interesting to me that the Coen Brothers are in and of themselves a genre, you know, that you can do that with. And I think you can. There's a game called Fiasco. It's improvisers like it. It's basically just a book. I think you can download it even. And it's like essentially like a role-playing like set of rules in which you kind of, they describe it as basically playing a Coen Brothers movie. And like, that's what, it's a fiasco, you know, it's people with like grand ambition and low impulse control. And like, if you're lucky at the end of the game, it's really just to have a good time. You end up kind of back where you started. You know, you didn't gain anything, you didn't lose anything, you know, but if you're not lucky, you know, you're much lower than you started. And I just think that's like such a good description of the average Coen Brothers movie, from the simple plan, not simple plan, what is it? Blood Simple.
The best laid plans.
Well, yeah, but yeah, yes, the term, but Blood Simple or Fargo, you know, on that side. And then there's like, you know, Big Lebowski on the other side. And some of them were, you know, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Some of them were like kind of stranger goofball movies, but they're fiascos. Everything, they just love a good, they love a good fiasco.
Well, that's probably a good place to start kind of getting into the recap of the movie, because I think as we kind of go scene by scene, these, all these interesting points will kind of emerge as we talk about it. So we start with listening to the Tumblin' Tumbleweeds, which is a pretty good metaphor for Jeff Lebowski, who is a tumbleweed that rolls through life. And we watch a tumbleweed roll through these shots of Los Angeles. And we hear human mustache Sam Elliott, mm-hmm, as the stranger narrate us into saying this is a story that doesn't make sense.
Way out west, there was this fella I want to tell you about. Fella by the name of Jeff Lebowski. At least that was the handle his loving parents gave him. And he never had much use for it himself. This Lebowski, he called himself the Dude. Now, Dude, that's a name no one would self-apply where I come from. But then there was a lot about the Dude that didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. And a lot about where he lived, likewise. But then again, maybe that's why I found the place so darn interesting. They call Los Angeles the City of Angels. I didn't find it to be that exactly. But all odds, there are some nice folks there. Of course, I can't say I've seen London. And I've never been to France. And I ain't never seen no queen in her damned undies, as the fella says. But I'll tell you what, after seeing Los Angeles and this here story I'm about to unfold, I guess I've seen something every bit as stupefying as you'd see in any of those other places. And in English, too. So I can die with a smile on my face without feeling like the good Lord gypped me.
It's stupefying, he says.
Call him the Dude. Right? All these...
Yep. And he introduces us to the Dude, who we watch buy one carton of milk with a check for 60 some odd
cents. Is it milk or is it half and half?
Oh, it might be half and half.
I think it's half and half.
It's even weirder. That's right, for his white Russians he's going to make, yeah. Yeah,
just drinking it while he waits.
Yeah, and we hear he's high in the running for laziest worldwide, because he's the laziest man in Los Angeles. And we hear George Bush say this aggression will not stand, which obviously he will repeat in a moment. And then he comes home to his apartment for some mayhem. But we'll stop there for a minute to talk about this. Very sort of dreamy opening to the movie.
Again, I don't know that it's unique to Los Angeles, but just being in a grocery store late at night behind a guy in a bathrobe buying half and half with a check. It seems like a good introduction.
Well, exactly. It sort of, it puts you in the place right away, and, you know, sets up a, future joke, because it's, you know, I think it's specifically a Ralph's, and he tries to later use a Ralph's card for ID. you immediately get a sense of the place. You also get a sense of like sort of the dreamy qualities that would also come later in the movie, you know, some of his hallucinations, which you know, are definitely a key aesthetic part of the film.
Well, that's another point about the movie, that it does have at times a dream logic. Certainly what's Sam Elliott's character's name? Is he just the cowboy or something?
The stranger.
The stranger. Yeah. So he's this like kind of God figure, you know, and you could argue, and like, yeah. So there's some interesting metaphysical stuff happening too.
And even on an aesthetic level, like, yes, there are the hallucinatory sequences we'll talk about when we get there. But there's also stuff that, like, even within the reality of the movie, is filmed in a way to make it seem surreal and just weird. And that starts right here. So Jeff Bridges comes home to his apartment and is immediately accosted by these two dudes who are desperate to find the money he's supposed to have.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Oh. You want that money, Lebowski? Bunny says you're good for it. Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the fucking money, shithead?
Oh, it's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
Don't fuck with us. Your wife owes money to Jackie Treehorn. That means you owe money to Jackie Treehorn.
Ever thus the deadbeats, Lebowski.
No, don't do that. Not on the rug, man.
See? See what happens, Lebowski? You see what happens?
Nobody calls me Lebowski. You got the wrong guy. I'm the dude, man.
Your name's Lebowski, Lebowski. Your wife is Bunny.
My wife, Bunny? Do you see a wedding ring on my finger? Does this place look like I'm fucking married? The toilet seat's up, man.
What the fuck is this?
Obviously, you're not a golfer.
And one of them, a Chinaman, Wu, pees on his rug.
I don't believe that's the preferred emotion. Nomenclature.
It is not.
We're not talking about the guys that built the fucking railroads.
We'll get there. But yeah, like, he pees on the rug, and he basically explains to them, hey, do I look like a millionaire? Why would you come looking here for $1 million?
By the way, this is very, film noir-y too, just the quipping, you know, the PI or whatever, who's, you know, making wisecracks while he's getting beaten up. I mean, there's such a great line when the guy, like, shows him the bowling ball and he's like, what the fuck is this? Or something. And he's like, clearly you're not a golfer.
Hey, at least I'm housebroken. Yeah, like, he does make a bunch of quips, like the whole business with, like, pulling his sunglasses out of the toilet and, you know, putting them on his head.
Yep.
You know, like, it's all played for laughs. It's very, very funny. Like, I think when he's stuffing his head there in the toilet, he's like, it's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
Yeah, I mean, that's so Philip Marlowe.
Well, yeah, that's a key aspect of Marlowe, is he's getting humiliated in his own things. He, you know, in his story, he can get beat up. You know, it's just, you know, the world is very hard on him, even though he prevails in the end. And the dude deals with the same.
Yeah, it's a great opening, because, like, it feels very Coen Brothers-y, that, like, you know, basically 4 seconds into the movie, it's like, oh, crime's happening. You know, we're in that world already. But they leave, they slam the door. Bob Dylan's The Man in Me kicks in, which is sort of the unofficial theme song of the movie. And we get this, you know, bowling ballet, basically, as we sort of, the camera sort of lovingly shows us the beauty of the inside of a Los Angeles bowling alley.
More dreamy, 1991. You know, another kind of dreamy sort of feel.
Yeah. Yeah,
like, there's, like, one point, I think, where they have, like, all the people come up to roll the ball, but, like, in this almost, you know, balletic sequence, you know, like, just one after the other after
swimming,
the other.
It looks like, yeah.
I believe this was also, Hollywood Bowl. I think it's no longer there. I think that's where they filmed it. If I could, unless I had that wrong.
I've heard that. I've also heard, though, that some of it was filmed in a bowling alley in like Lawndale or Gardena or something that. I mean, yeah. I think there might have been more than one location, but yeah. But
yeah, I don't think you can just go to one that looks like it anymore, you know, unfortunately.
No. We can look that up. But anyway, yeah, I think there might have been more than one location, but...
But yeah, to the extent you can romanticize bowling, that's what this is, right? They're like the guy, like, spraying the shoes lovingly, and the, you know, kind of the unglamorous guy just, like, you know, just dancing because he got a strike.
Well, another interesting thing is, you know, and I feel like the Coen brothers have been accused of not liking their characters sometimes, or being kind of mean to their characters. But this is a movie where, you know, they really do ride that line between making fun of and celebrating, you know, and I think they do it pretty well. Like, it doesn't seem mocking, you know?
No.
No, it's like, it's sort of sweet, right? Like, this reminds me, we did an episode recently on Happy Gilmore, and there's like that scene where they focus in on the guy, the Zamboni driver singing Endless Love. And it's just sort of like, oh, what if we just hold this guy, like, just having a nice moment to himself, you know, like nobody's watching. Like, there's a little of that here. Yeah. But speaking of, you know, again, these characters that they sort of treat sort of mean, but with their own sort of love. We meet Donnie, played by Steve Buscemi, who is, as we said, throwing rocks tonight.
Woo! I'm throwing rocks tonight. Mark it, dude.
This was a valued rock. This was a...
Yeah, man, it really tied the room together.
So this was a valued,
Yeah. What tied the room together, dude?
My rug.
Were you listening to the dude's story, Donnie?
Walter.
Were you listening to the dude's story?
I was bowling.
So you have no frame of reference here, Donnie. You're like a child who wanders into the middle of a movie and wants to know...
Walter, what's the point, man?
There's no reason. Here's my point, dude. There's no fucking reason why these...
Yeah, Walter, what's your point?
Huh?
Walter, what is the point? Look, we all know who is at fault here. What the fuck are you talking about?
Huh? No, what the fuck are you... I'm not... We're talking about unchecked aggression here,
dude. What the fuck is he talking
about? My rug.
Forget it, Donnie. You're out of your element.
Walter, the Chinaman who peed on my rug, I can't go give him a bill. So what the fuck are you talking about?
What the fuck are you talking about? The Chinaman is not the issue here, dude. I'm talking about drawing a line in the sand, dude. Across this line, you do not. Also, dude, Chinaman is not the preferred nomenclature. Asian American, please.
And Walter and the dude are talking about the beating that just took place and the ruination of his rug, which really tied the room together.
Another kind of little bit of a running gag that the rug tied the room together.
Yes, he keeps mentioning that.
Yeah, it did tie the room together.
A room that probably has, you know, four things in it.
Yeah, it's a pretty decent rug, all considered. I don't know where Jeff Lebowski would have gotten that rug from, but they hit on the idea in this scene after telling Donnie he's out of his element several times that what they need to do is they need to go to the big Lebowski, the other Jeff, the millionaire Jeffrey Lebowski, and he should ask him to pay him for the rug, because apparently this is all his wife's bunny's fault, and therefore he should make it up to the dude.
And of course, this is another classic film noir premise: is the mistaken identity.
Yes,
you know, that kicks off many mystery plots.
Yes,
that and the as you said, Dylan, the like the millionaire who who's in this case wife, his young trophy wife,
yeah,
is getting him into trouble.
Right, exactly. It's his trophy wife and the big sleep. It's his daughter, yeah.
Yeah. So they decide to do that. They're going to go, and we have Brandt, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, in the first big thing I can remember him in, showing the dude around the very fancy offices of the Big Lebowski, including the Little Lebowski Urban Achievers, their charity, which will become very important.
This is a study. As you can see, the various commendations, awards, citations, honorary degrees, etc.
Very impressive.
Oh, please feel free to inspect them.
Oh, no, I'm not really...
Oh, please, please. That is the key to the city of Pasadena, which Mr. Lebowski received 2 years ago in recognition of his various civic... That's the Los Angeles Chamber of Commerce Business Achiever Award, which is given, well, not necessarily given every year, only when there's a worthy somebody.
Is this him with Nancy?
Yes, indeed. That is Mr. Lebowski with the First Lady, yes. Yeah. Let's take in when Mrs.
That's
Reagan.
That's Lebowski on the left there?
Yeah, of course, Mr. Lebowski on the left.
So he's handicapped guy?
Mr. Lebowski is disabled, yes. This picture was taken when Mrs. Reagan was First Lady of the Nation. Yes, yes. Not of California.
Chuck?
In fact, he met privately with the president, though unfortunately there wasn't enough time for a photo opportunity.
Oh, Nancy's pretty good.
Oh, wonderful woman. We were very happy to...
These are,
Those are Mr. Lebowski's children.
Different
so
mothers,
to speak.
Huh?
No, they're not.
Racially, he's pretty cool.
They're not literally his children. They're the little Lebowski urban achievers, inner city children of promise, but without the necessary means for a higher education. So Mr. Lebowski is committed to sending all of them to college. Excuse me. Thank you.
Fire out. Think he's got room for one more?
And I love it. Is there room for one more? Then we meet the Big Lebowski, who is a human cartoon, millionaire in a wheelchair, who essentially completely disregards the dude and says, look, you're just looking for a handout. Get the fuck out of here. And so
the war's over. The bum's lost.
Oh, God, I forgot that line. Yeah.
Speaking of like little jokes that carry through, right? We just had, as you mentioned, that whole thing about like, hey, Chinaman's not the preferred nomenclature. Big Lebowski here says something about his paralysis. He says, I lost my legs in the war. Some Chinaman took them from me in Korea.
Okay. So carrying this racism forward.
Brief aside, you said that Big Lebowski was the first, big role you saw Philip Seymour Hoffman in. He had a bigger role in a Todd Solondz movie that came out that same year called Happiness. But what's interesting is that one of his co-stars in Happiness was Ben Gazzara, who played Jackie Treehorn in The Big Lebowski.
Yeah, sometimes could be similar casting person, yeah. You never know.
Yeah, it could be the same casting director. That's true. Same year. Anyway, sorry.
I really like the Big Lebowski character. I mean, like I said, he's very broad as a character, but I just find his deal very funny, especially when we learn more about what's actually going on here.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he keeps talking about all his achievements and the achievers.
Like, strong men also cry, Mr. Lebowski. Strong men also cry.
Yeah. But I love, after he just yells at Lebowski to get the fuck out, he walks away and Brandt's there to go like, oh, how was your meeting? And he says, oh, great. He said to take any rug in the house.
Rug in the house.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Great stuff. So now we're up to, they're walking out of the house and we meet Bunny, played by Tara Reid. I think this is before American Pie.
Yes.
And she's painting her nails. She introduces us to Uli, played by Peter Stormare, who is just passed out on an inner tube in the pool. And he's a nihilist. And then she offers
they're Nazis? It's like, no. These men, they're nihilists. These men are cowards.
Yeah. And then I believe Bonnie offers what I assume would be a very overpriced blowjob. I don't really know.
For 1998? I don't know.
For $1,000. Yeah. And we get the greatest nostril flare in history as Philip Seymour Hoffman tries to get this under control before they leave.
Yeah, he's very flustered by it.
He's like he's this incredible Smithers character. Like he's as a live action Smithers, he's perfect.
Mm. Yes. Yeah, he is. He really is.
Do they ever, I don't think they ever do, give you any reason to understand why this guy is tied at the hip to Big Lebowski?
No, you can come up with your own backstory.
Just.
He didn't live long enough to give us a Brandt spinoff, unfortunately. But.
Thank God.
No. Yeah. I think, he derives his importance from being around this important man.
You get the sense, it's probably a key character for understanding the Big Lebowski because, this guy's so full of himself. So obviously he needs somebody else who's going to the one other person who's feeding that because nobody else seems to. His wife or whatever, doesn't care. He's a joke to her, he's clearly living in a dream world. So he's got this one guy who buys into it. And they usually do. They usually have one.
Yep.
Yeah, the other detail here is Bunny is painting her toenails, which track for later, with a distinctive dark greenish color. So they go back to the bowling alley, and we start to get layered in here Walter's weird Judaism angle. He's quoting Theodore Herzl. If you will it, it is no dream. And then Smokey possibly puts a toe over the line, causing Walter to lose his fucking mind.
First of all, dude, you don't have an accent. Secondly, this is a fucking show dog with fucking papers. You can't board it. It gets upset. Hey, its man, hair falls out.
Walter.
Fucking no. Dog has fucking papers. Over the line!
Huh?
I'm sorry, Smokey. You were over the line. That's a foul.
Bullshit. Mark it 8, dude.
Excuse me. Mark it 0. Next frame.
Bullshit, Walter. Mark it 8, dude.
Smokey, this is not Nom. This is bowling. There are rules.
Hey, Walter, come on. It's just... Hey, man, it's Smokey, so his toe slipped over a little, you know? It's just a game, man.
This is a league game. This determines who enters the next round robin. Am I wrong?
Yeah, but I wasn't...
Am I wrong?
Yeah, but I wasn't over. Give me the marker, dude. I'm marking an 8.
Smokey, my friend, you're entering a world of pain.
Walter, man.
You mark that frame an 8, you're entering a world of pain.
I'm not...
A world of pain.
Look, dude, This is your partner.
Has the whole world gone crazy? Am I the only one around here who gives a shit about the rules? Mark it 0.
They're calling the cops, man. Put the piece away.
Mark it 0.
Walter, put the piece away.
Walter?
You think I'm fucking around here? Mark it 0.
All right, it's fucking 0. You happy, you crazy fuck?
The league game, Smoke.
Yeah, Walter, isn't he Jewish because of his ex-wife? Is that?
Yeah, he is not. Yeah, he converted for his ex-wife.
Which is another, because they got these funny...
When what gets divorced, one does not hand in a library card, one does not re-register to vote, and one does not stop being fucking Jewish!
That's another just fun element of Walter, is that, you know, he's got this hilariously, like... unhealthy relationship with his ex-wife where he's like watching her dog. You never see her or anything, but it's just it's just really funny.
Practicing her religion very, very personally.
Yeah. It's a pretty funny little character trait.
And also they're going with the like classic, like I guess non-veteran who has flashbacks or PTSD or something that he threatens to blow this poor guy's brains out for stepping a toe over the line. He talks about, like, this isn't Nom, there are rules.
This isn't Nom, you know. There are rules.
Yeah.
Yeah, fucking crazy. But this is, this is like our first, like, we get that, like, Walter's a little off in the first scene, but this is where we realize, oh, he is a real loose cannon. So, all right, so...
By the way, the loose cannon, always a good element to throw into a fiasco. Somebody whose behavior is not predictable.
Correct. They continue this conversation out into the parking lot where he says he briefly dabbled in pacifism, which I can't think of Walter ever dabbling in pacifism, but we hear some sirens, so I guess they managed to drive on out of there before the cops showed up and arrested him for threatening someone with a gun. And we go back to the scene where Jeff is listening to his answering machine on his new fancy rug. Smokey is reporting the incident to the league. Lebowski makes himself a white Russian, and then Brandt is calling him. We don't know why. He keeps calling him over and over again. And then we meet the landlord.
Mr. Lebowski, this is Mel Zellinger of the Southern Cal Bowling League. I just got an informal report that a member of your team, Walter Soljak, drew a firearm during league play. If this is true, of course, it contravenes a number of the league's bylaws and also Article 27 of the league.
Dude.
Hey, Marty.
Dude, I finally got the venue I wanted. I'm performing my dance quintet, you know, my cycle, at Crane Jackson's Fountain Street Theater on Tuesday night, and I'd love it if you came and gave me notes.
I'll be there, man.
Tomorrow's already the 10th.
Far out. Oh, all right, okay.
Just slipped the rent under my door.
Serious infraction. Stand examine your standing. Thank you. Mr. Lebowski, Brandt again. Please do call us as soon as you get in and I'll send a limo.
I hope you're not avoiding this call because of the rug, which I assure you is not a problem. We need your help, and, well, we would very much like to see you. Thank you. It's Brad.
This dude is so, like, perfect, like Coen Brothers and weird.
Yeah, I mean, there's the stereotypical landlord who's, like, you know, beating down your door for the rent or whatever, and this guy is just a complete pushover, and it's really funny.
Seems much more interested in his own performing career than
right
making money.
He calls it his his dance quintet. He also calls it his cycle.
Yeah.
I love we get to actually get the fact that we get to see this thing, or at least some piece of it later, is brilliant. It's like a great time.
I mean, I know LA is not the only city where that's a thing, but it's definitely a city where that's a thing, where you're like, I've got to go see my friend's weird show.
Yeah, definitely LA has more than its share of like little black box theaters where weird things happen for people to harass their friends into going to see it.
Yep.
And this is one of those. But yeah, so we meet him quickly before he goes back in. And then there's another call from Brandt. And they basically say, like, hey, we're sending a limo for you. And now we get the scene of the Big Lebowski in seclusion in the West Wing, accompanied by Mozart's Requiem.
I can look back on a life of achievement, challenges met, competitors bested, obstacles overcome. I've accomplished more than most men, and without the use of my legs. What makes a man, Mr. Lebowski?
Dude.
Huh?
I don't know, sir.
Is it being prepared to do the right thing? Whatever the cost. Isn't that what makes a man?
Sure, that and a pair of testicles.
You're joking, but perhaps you're right.
You mind if I do it, Jay?
Bunny.
Excuse me?
Bunny Lebowski. She is the light of my life. Are you surprised at my tears, sir?
Good fucking hey.
Strong men also cry. Strong men also cry. I received this fax this morning.
Oh, this is where that is. All that is. Okay, yeah.
This is the strong men also cry.
Excuse me, yes. Because now Bunny's missing.
I would say Bunny, but yeah, Bunny has been supposedly kidnapped. There's a ransom note, and they need the dude's help. This scene. Like how disconnected Jeff Bridges is here, where he's just like, I'm just going to light up a doobie while you're telling me this. I always found that to be really funny.
It's a bummer, man.
Yeah, it's a bummer. Fucking A. Yeah. Like one of the things about this, again, like if this feels very noir, like it's shot in a more noir way with like, he's by the fireplace and you know, they really kind of play up the opulence of this mansion.
They
do. No thoughts on that.
Okay. Just, would you have a question?
No, not really.
Just about that.
This is a bummer. So yeah, so the plan is the dude's going to act as courier because in theory he would recognize the culprits because supposedly the kidnappers are also the rug peers. And so they're going to give the dude a beeper and eventually tell him what he needs to do to be the courier for the ransom payment. That is the stated plan. And now we go back to the bowling alley again, where we meet the Jesus. Holy fucking shit, this thing from Dr. Turo is so weird.
That makes me fucking sick.
Well, what do you care, Walter?
Those rich fucks. This whole fucking thing. I did not watch my buddies die face down in the muck so that this fucking strumpet, this
Walter,
fucking whore,
I don't see any
could waltz around
with Vietnam, man.
Well, there isn't literal connection,
no, Walter,
dude.
Face it, there isn't any connection. You're wrong.
Have it your way, but my
You're
point
wrong.
Is that my point
You're
is.
Are you wrong. Ready to be fucked, man? I see you roll your way into the semis. Dios mío, man. Liam and me, we're gonna fuck you up. Yeah, well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man. Let me tell you something, Pandeo. You pull any of your crazy shit with us, you flash a piece out on the lanes, I'll take it away from you and stick it up your ass and pull the fucking trigger till it goes click.
Jesus.
You said it, man. Nobody fucks with the Jesus.
Eight-year-olds, dude.
I mean, he's just described as a pederast by Walter.
Yeah, eight-year-olds, dude.
So weird.
Eight-year-olds, dude.
The whole, like, just him dancing to the Gypsy Kings covering Hotel California is just like, they spend so much time lovingly setting that up.
Well, this movie is, it's this weird mix of, like, very important little bits of information, like Bunny painting her toenails green, like, that's going to come back. And then just these weird digressions that don't come back and aren't important, but are just flavor and fun. And the Jesus is not an important plot element at all.
No, he really isn't.
But it's just weird and fun and strange, you know, let's do it. Similarly, later on, you know, that whole extended scene where we'll get to with Larry, you know, and in the report card or the school report or whatever, like incredibly long and detailed and weird, you know.
Yep.
But they go so far as to even give you, like, I won't call it a full, like, flashback, but, like, when Walter's telling this story about, oh, yeah, this guy's a pedophile, and he had to go door to door, like, they cut to a shot of, like, John Turturro walking up to somebody's door to knock on it. Like, they really spend a lot of time, you know, filling in this just, as you said, it's flavor.
Yeah, very confident. Again, just like, this is strange. This is flavor. This adds to the... I mean, it's a very tonal movie. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons people kind of get confused by it. The plot is very secondary.
Yeah. It definitely feels... Yeah, go ahead. Sorry, Dylan.
No. Just it seemed like a jumping off point for them to be able to indulge in all these things that interested them, like the loving choreographed bowling shots and the psychedelic dream sequences.
Like a lot of filmmakers, they're not beyond just saying, like, oh, you know, this is that thing we've always wanted to do. We can do it in this movie. You know? I mean, Buster Scruggs, I think, is literally just that. It's like these, like, stories that they had written over, like, decades. And they're like, let's put it just in one thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
It feels like a sketch. Like, they met somebody who was weird at some point in their lives, or they heard about a guy, and they're like, let's just splice this into the movie.
Yeah. It's just like, I think it's one of the secrets to good filmmaking is putting things in that the trick is to make other people enjoy it too, but things that you enjoy. I mean, that's all Quentin Tarantino does. It's just like, these are things that Quentin Tarantino likes, and, you know, I hope you like it, because if you don't, you're gonna be real annoyed. But, like, yeah, this is clearly them just being like, yeah, maybe it's a guy they knew or something, just tickled him.
Yeah, it's just a fun diversion, and as we'll go through it, the movie is full of these, and it just feels like you said, like, there's just this confidence in going, like, we want to just treat the audience to something that's going to be fun, and there's room for it. Like, it does take a confident filmmaker to do that, because you know somewhere there's an executive or an editor or somebody going, like, why is this in here? Why don't we cut this? Like, it's funny, but it doesn't drive the plot at all. So, you know, you need someone like the Coen brothers to go, like, no, this, we need the Jesus in this movie.
You don't fuck with Jesus.
Nobody fucks with him. Yeah.
Take that gun from you, stick it up your ass, and pull the trigger till the gun goes click.
And one of the things the dude says in the middle of kind of explaining his new role as courier to Walter is he, I believe he's the first one to float this idea that, you know, she probably kidnapped herself.
Mm-hmm.
Because Walter seizes on that.
Yes.
And will continue to seize on that. He just assumes that, yes, of course, she probably kidnapped herself. Awesome, of course, that is in fact exactly what happened. She didn't even kidnap herself, as we'll find out later. She just blew town. She just left for a while.
Walter's very conspiratorial.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. But it's also a very noir, you know, trope that, like, the solution to the puzzle has been in plain sight the whole time. And in fact, it's been treated as a joke that they keep saying she probably kidnapped herself, as the seriousness appears to keep mounting. because we were like, no, you can't take, look, there's a fucking toe, you know, in a napkin. Like, you
so
know,
yeah, so the kidnappers sent, this is where the nail polish comes back into play. Has this happened yet in the movie?
Uh-uh. Yeah.
Okay. This comes later. All right.
No. Yeah. The toe comes later, but just my point being that like, no matter how like dire things appear to get or get worse, they just, Walter going, she probably kidnapped herself. Mm. What we're supposed to think is, Walter, you fucking idiot. Like, of course she didn't kidnap herself. Shit got real. Yeah. But that's part of the joke, because that is exactly what happened. All right. So the dude is listening to Bowling on a Walkman back at home, just listening to a cassette tape of, you know, of the sounds of Bowling. Then he looks up to see some people, including who we'll later find out is Maude Lebowski, played by Julianne Moore. And they punch him in the face. And we have our first dream sequence to The Man and Me again.
Yeah.
Just again, like just fun, weird shit that they're like, I don't know. What if he just like, you know, was imagined he was tiny and inside a bowling ball or riding a magic carpet? Like the rug was the carpet. So, I don't know what to make of this stuff. Other than,
I mean,
just, like,
the
again,
stuff that they're fighting for to make this movie, you know, these sets, these setups, you know, these characters. I got, you know, what did they do right before this? Do you know?
I thought it was Fargo.
Fargo.
Okay, so they had some clout.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, Fargo was nominated for Best Picture. It's, you know,
really ever since Raising Arizona, they had a name for themselves.
Yeah, it's true. And Raising Arizona is filled with a lot of strange stuff. So yeah. But yeah, just imagine.
And Barton Fink came before this. Barton Fink has some really weird psychedelic stuff.
Yeah. So does Hudsucker Proxy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I mean, it's in keeping with the Coen Brothers' style, but you know, it's still interesting that they are, you know, especially again comparing it to Fargo, has none of this. Mm-hmm. You know, Fargo is much more, I mean, it has its twists and turns, but it doesn't have this level of like surreality to it.
Yeah, no.
So it's interesting to watch them go like hard, like, oh well, now
neither
we
just
did
Miller's Crossing, which came before this also.
Yeah. So he wakes back up on the floor and the rug is gone. That's continuing the case of the missing rug. And he gets the call from Brandt that now, you know, the kidnappers have given their instruction and it's time for him to do his duty. He is handed the standard 90s movie metal briefcase and is told her life is in your hands.
Her
dude.
Life is in your hands, dude.
They called about 80 minutes ago. They want you to take the money, drive north on the 405. They will call you on the portable phone with instructions in about 40 minutes. One person only. They were very clear on that, or I'd go with you. One person only. What happened to your jaw?
Oh, nothing.
Here's the money. And the phone. Please, dude, follow whatever instructions they give.
All right.
Her life is in your hands.
What, man? Don't say
that. Mr. Lebowski asked me to repeat that. Her life is in your hands.
Yeah.
Her life is in your hands, dude. And report back to us as soon as it's done.
But critically, he's given a couple of key instructions, which he immediately breaks. One of which is, of course, he's supposed to go alone. And instead, he brings Walter, who is packing some enormous gun that we can't really see because it's like wrapped up in brown paper. And we go to this scene where they try to do the handoff and things go fiasco. Horribly, mm-hmm. horribly wrong. This whole thing is such a cluster. It's really funny.
Well, yeah, so I know Walter switches the case because he throws his dirty laundry, the whites.
Right.
Yes.
And then why do they not even... Undies. Are they supposed to throw it over the bridge? Is that what's supposed to happen?
The what they're supposed to do is drive over this bridge, toss the briefcase seemingly full of money to the people who are down below on these motorcycles, and they will just take the money and leave. That's the ransom handoff that's supposed to happen. And already things are nervous because when the dude is on the phone to them, he uses we when he's only supposed to be alone. The royal we, you know.
The editorial.
Yeah. So, but the kidnappers let him proceed. But yeah, then it's like Walter's going to like, yeah, the plan is to throw out a ringer and they can just keep the money because he firmly believes that there has been no kidnapping. And it's all bullshit, so they'll just keep the money.
That was the sign, man.
So, what we're gonna do is get her back. No one's in a position to complain. We keep the back seat.
Yeah.
terrific, Walter, but you haven't told me how we're going to get her back. Where is she?
That's the simple part, dude. We make the handoff, I grab one of them, beat it out of them. Huh? Yeah.
That's a great plan, Walter. That's fucking ingenious, if I understand it correctly. It's a Swiss fucking watch.
That's right, dude. The beauty of this is its simplicity. Once a plan gets too complex, everything can go wrong. There's one thing I learned in Nam.
Dude.
You're coming to Buda Bridge. When you cross the bridge, you throw the bag from the left window of the moving car. You're being watched.
Fuck.
What do you say? Where's the handoff?
There is no fucking handoff, man. At the wooden bridge, we throw the money out of the car.
Huh?
We throw the money out of the moving car.
Well, we can't do that, dude. That fucks up our plan.
Well, call them up and explain it to them, Walter. Your plan is so fucking simple, and they'll fucking understand it. That's the beauty of it.
Wooden bridge, huh?
Throwing the money, Walter. We're not fucking around, man.
Okay, dude, the bridge is coming up. Give me the ringer. Chop, chop.
Fuck that. Walter, I love you, but sooner or later, you're going to have to face the fact you're a goddamn moron.
Okay, dude, no time to argue.
Hey, man.
That's the bridge.
Hey, Walter. Hey, Walter. Hey, Walter.
There goes the ringer. Okay, dude, your wheel. 15 mph, I roll out. I double back to grab one of them and beat it out of them. Lucy.
Lucy?
You didn't think I was rolling out of your neck, did you?
Walter,
15, please. Dude, this is it. Let's take that hill. Walter. Ah!
But then he rolls out of the car, and, like, the gun falls out, and just bullets are flying everywhere, while Credence's Better Run Through the Jungle is playing, setting up a Credence joke later. Like, the whole thing is just, again, like, it's a complete clusterfuck, and then Walter ends with, fuck it, dude, let's go bowling. The thesis of the movie.
That explains, it's a good philosophy for life in general.
Yeah, again, like, it's the same kind of, like, crime gone, you know, best laid plans go to waste kind of stuff that the Coen brothers love, but in a much more funny, you know, comical mold than something like Fargo.
Yep.
All right, so we go back to the bowling alley. The phone keeps ringing. The Brandt phone is ringing, and dude's definitely too scared shitless to answer it. And now we get the they don't roll on Shabbos.
That's right, dude. 100% certain.
They posted the next round for the tournament.
Donnie, shut the fuck up. When do we play?
Saturday.
Saturday. Well, I have to reschedule.
Walter, what am I going to tell Lebowski?
I told that fuck down at the league office. Who's in charge of scheduling?
Walter.
Burkhalter.
I told that crowd a fucking 1,000 times I don't roll on Shabbos.
Walter.
They already posted it.
Well, they can fucking unpost it.
Who gives a shit? They're going to kill that poor woman, man. What am I going to tell Lebowski?
Come on, dude. Eventually she'll get tired of her little game and, you know, wander on back.
Yeah.
How come you don't roll on Saturday, Walter?
I'm Shomer Shabbos.
What's that, Walter?
Yeah, and in the meantime, what do I tell Lebowski?
Saturday, Donnie, is Shabbos, the Jewish day of rest. That means I don't work. I don't drive a car. I don't fucking ride in a car. I don't handle money. I don't turn on the oven. And I sure as shit don't fucking roll!
Sheesh.
Shomer Shabbos!
Walter, how am I going to...
Show more fucking shots.
Oh, fuck. That's it. I'm out of here.
Oh, come on, dude.
By the way, I am Jewish. I'm not aware of any rule that would prevent you from bowling on the Sabbath.
It depends how Jewish you are. I mean, there's, you know, you can't... If you're a super observer, you can't open a door on the Sabbath.
Yeah, I just don't know if rolling a bowling ball in a game is considered work. It seems like it's, you know, play.
Hmm. It's not in service of the Lord, though. Not sure.
Probably not.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll ask a rabbi.
Yeah. Maybe if you don't open the door to enter the bowling alley. I don't know.
Yep. And when they leave, they find that the dude's car is now stolen.
Yep.
It's setting up another thing that will ultimately go nowhere.
Which, you know, dead ends, red herrings, you know, it's mystery stuff.
Yeah, they tend to go pretty hard. Like, I feel like some of these red herrings, they really let them, these threads dangle for a long time.
Oh, yeah, I know. Because, I mean, that's one of the weird things about this movie that confuses people. People aren't sure what to follow, what's important, what's not.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's ultimately a much simpler movie than it appears to be. Like, the ultimate solution as to what's going on is incredibly simple.
Yeah.
The circuitous route they take to get there.
I mean, it definitely, you know, it's one of the movies that people probably saw less as a Burn After Reading. But, you know, it has, yeah. Burn After Reading has that element to it, too, where it's like just a lot of, at the end, I think they're like, so what was this all about? They're literally like wondering, you know?
Yeah. All right. So the dude is now meeting with the police at his apartment, reporting the stolen car. They're asked if there was anything of value in the car. And poor Jeff Bridges tries to say, well, you know, a tape deck, some credence, and his briefcase with his business papers.
Business papers. Yeah, I think every scene in this movie is probably memorable. And, you know, talking to the police and, you know, do you have any leads? Is that...
Well, that's where they, yeah, that's yeah, where they find the car.
Yeah, we got him working in shifts.
Yeah, leads.
Wouldn't hold out much hope for the Creedence tapes, they say.
Yeah. But yeah, I think this is one where there's the two cops, and, you know, one is just kind of laughing and cynical, and the other one is actually a very Brandt-like figure. It's kind of funny. And he's like, ooh, separate incidents or something.
Right, because he mentions the rug was stolen in a separate
yeah,
incident.
So yeah, so just... This movie is a good example of there's not a wasted character. Even the minor characters are notable and funny, even if they're just a couple of lines of dialogue.
Yeah, there's definitely just like everyone in it is just a little bit off, and that it makes them like kind of pop as characters. It's really fun. But we get, while the cops are there, we get the message from Maude Lebowski, who tells him that she's the one who took the rug. And so the cops are thrilled. That solves one of their two cases.
Now, who's Maude in relation to the other Lebowski? What's her relationship?
She's his daughter.
His daughter. Yeah. Okay.
She's his daughter. And the mother is the one who really had the money.
Right.
And we're about to spend some time with Maude, because after that phone call, we get one of the very surreal things in the movie as dude walks down this hallway where all of a sudden we hear this like horror movie screeching, but it's actually a naked Julianne Moore in a harness, like splattering paint on a canvas. Like, This is like, I remember people like jumped in the theater. Like, it is like played as like a real jump scare moment. It's very weird.
These are all people I feel like I've met after Lost Moon Radio shows. You know, like just throwing yourself naked against a canvas covered in paint. Oh, cool.
Yeah.
And so now Maude kind of tries to tell us what's really going on, that basically, you know, she doesn't trust Bunny at all, which why would you?
Is this also, is Knox Harrington in the scene? I'm trying to remember where all these are.
No, he's the
later.
He's
okay,
the
I'm keeping later. It ahead of myself. I'm sorry. Not that it matters. Yeah. Like, this is so narratively driven. But, okay.
So this is the scene where we learn about log jamming.
He likes sex, Mr. Lebowski.
Excuse me?
Sex, the physical act of love. Coitus. Do you like it?
I was talking about my rug.
You're not interested in sex?
You mean coitus?
I like it too. It's a male myth about feminists that we hate sex. It can be a natural, zesty enterprise. However, there are some people, it is called satyriasis in men, nymphomania in women, who engage in it compulsively and without joy.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes, Mr. Lebowski. These unfortunate souls cannot love in the true sense of the word. Our mutual acquaintance, Bunny, is one of these.
Listen, Maude, I'm sorry if your stepmother is a nympho, but, you know, I don't see what this has to do with, you have any Kahlua?
Take a look at this, sir.
Oh, I know that guy. Yeah, he's a nihilist. Carl Hungus.
And the dispatcher says there's something wrong with Dinah Cabo.
Yeah, come on in. I'm not really sure exactly what's really wrong with the cable. Well,
that's why they sent me. I'm an expert.
The TV's in here.
You recognize her, of course.
Way my tools.
Oh, that's my friend Sherry. She just came over to use a shower.
The story is ludicrous.
My name is Carl Ishbin Expert.
You must be here to fix the cable.
Lord, you can imagine where it goes from here.
He fixes the cable?
Yes. Oh, okay. The adult film that
and we
Bunny
find
was
out
in?
That, Bunny was in a porn with Uli, the Peter yes. Stormare, playing Carl Hungus. The story is ludicrous. all this is really just great, funny stuff. Maude is, you know, except again, like just a strange specimen of a human. But we do find out that her father withdrew $1 million from the Little Lebowski Urban Achiever charity to pay the ransom for Bunny. And Maude says if he can find the money, then he'll get a finder's fee of 10%. And then she tells him to go see the doctor, who's a good man and thorough.
Right, because of his injury from what, the car accident or?
Well, that's what she tells him.
Well,
that's
yeah, I was going to say there's a reason she says,
yeah,
and
yeah,
there's
yeah,
a real
yeah, yeah.
reason.
Which is also very strange because, we could say it. It's not like, but she, you know, wants to conceive. And so yeah. she's checking his.
And for some reason, she wants his.
Because why not? Yeah, right? I mean,
yeah.
He seems like good stock. Yeah.
Does he?
Part of the Seattle 7?
Yeah, that is an unexplained part of the movie. Why him? I don't know if that's adequately explained.
Yeah. I think, oh, she does. She so later say she wanted someone who would be completely uninvolved with the child's life.
Right. Who, you know, so that tracks.
In disregard.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I love all this stuff. Like the porn is so well observed. Like this like terrible, just poorly shot thing. And the awful, he's like a cable repairman, right. Like, oh, he fixes the cable, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Really, really incredible. But of course, what Maude does not know is that as far as the dude knows, the money was in the car that got stolen.
Right.
So he's got a problem in terms of he's got to find the car to get the money back. So comedian Dom Herrera chauffeurs the dude home. He lets us know that there's someone following them in a VW Bug, which will come up later. And then he is accosted and shoved into a different car with the Big Lebowski and Brandt as he tries to salvage his beverage.
We've got a beverage here, man.
Yeah. And this is where, you know, they basically are furious because they fucked up the handoff. And now Bunny is probably dead, or at least in great danger, because they were sent a tow.
Mm-hmm. Ah, yes.
Where is my goddamn money, you bum?
I don't...
They did not receive the money, you nitwit! They did not receive the money! Her life was in your hands!
This is our concern, dude.
No, man, nothing is fucked here.
Nothing is fucked?
No, man.
The goddamn plane has crashed into the mountain!
No, man, come on. Who are you going to believe? Those guys are... We dropped off the damn money.
We?
I. The royal we. You know, the editorial. I dropped off the money exactly as per... Look, man, I've got certain information, all right? Certain things have come to light, and... You know, has it ever occurred to you that instead of... running around blaming me, you know, given the nature of all this new shit, you know, this could be a lot more complex. I mean, it's not just, it might not be just such a simple, you know?
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man. New shit has come to light. And shit, man... She kidnapped herself.
So I have a question here because in terms of the overall plot, because do they believe that Bunny was kidnapped, the Big Lebowski and Brandt, or do they know that that's also bullshit?
I don't remember well enough, but I can't imagine why they would think it was bullshit.
Yeah, I think that they.
I thought it was the nihilists were playing them.
Yeah, but he also says something like later on in the scene where they confront the nihilists. They're not Nazis. At least it's an ethos.
Yeah.
They confront the nihilists in the parking lot, and one of them says something like, his girlfriend gave up a toll. She thought we would get $1 million, or he said we would get $1 million. So I don't know if the Big Lebowski and them were in cahoots on that aspect.
Well,
of
you could easily interpret that as he offered them $1 million for, you know, I mean, it's not like,
Yeah. I just don't know if you know, because there is a ransom note. I just don't know if they believe that the ransom note is real or.
Well, the only thing that I'm trying to remember too. Now this is us trying to remember the Big Lebowski live here on the podcast, you know, they sent the argument for it was like, you send this schmuck out there so you can sort of plausibly deny, you know what I mean? Like, you could pin everything on him, you know, the money goes missing or whatever, you know.
Yep.
It's just a way to embezzle $1 million.
Yeah. Which is ultimately what they're trying to do. So Big Lebowski and Brandt tell the dude, you know, if you can't get the money, I'm going to tell them to get it out of you the hard way. So now he's in real trouble. So they go to a diner. Dude and Walter are in this diner where Walter is once again embarrassing himself. But he again now is saying, it's not her toe. I can get you a toe by 3 o'clock today.
With polish.
Which
that wasn't her toe, dude.
Whose toe was it, Walter?
The fuck should I know? I do know that nothing about it indicates.
Man, the nail polish, Walter.
Fine, dude. Guess if it's impossible to get some nail polish, apply it to someone else's toe.
Someone else? Where the fuck are they going to get...
You want a toe? I can get you a toe. Believe me. There are ways, dude. You don't want to know about it, believe me.
Yeah, but Walter...
Hell, I can get you a toe by 3 o'clock this afternoon with nail polish. Fucking amateur.
Walter.
They send us a toe. We're supposed to shit ourselves with fear. Jesus Christ.
Walter.
Now, the point is...
They're going to kill her, Walter, and then they're going to kill me.
Dude. That's... It's just the stress talking, man. Now, so far, we have what appears to me to be a series of victimless crimes.
What about the toe?
Forget about the fucking toe!
Excuse me, sir. Could you please keep your voices down? This is a family restaurant.
Oh, please, dear. For your information, the Supreme Court has roundly rejected prior restraint.
This is not a First Amendment thing,
sir,
man.
If you don't calm down, I'm going to have to ask you to leave.
Lady, I got buddies who died face down in the muck so that you and I could enjoy this family restaurant.
All right, I'm out of here.
Hey, dude, don't go away, man. Come on, this affects all of us, man. Our basic freedoms. I'm staying.
With polish, but again, awesome that he's right. It's not Bunny's toe, but the movie doesn't let you know that the first time through. Like, it's really great to watch. Like, it just seems like this guy's an idiot. Like, why does he not take this seriously now that there's a toe in play?
I mean, he's revealed to be an idiot in many ways, I think.
Well, that's true, but I just love the way that this is set up, right? Again, talking about things that are great on second viewing is like knowing that, like, yeah, he is right. And this poor lady who's trying to, like, serve them in the diner, too, while he's having yet another, you know, nom moment.
By the way, you know, this is most notable later on in the film, I think, during the eulogy. But one of the things I love about this movie is, you know, Walter's incredibly aggressive and the dude is very passive, except when they deal with each other, in which case it's completely inverted. The dude is very hostile towards Walter and Walter is incredibly submissive towards the dude. It's just a very funny little thing.
It's a good
idea. I never noticed that, but you're right.
Their relationship is completely inverted.
Yeah.
It's hard to imagine how they even became friends. Like, they are a very odd pairing for a couple of best friends. You know, again, with him.
Donnie, too.
Because what we know about the dude from his past is that it's, you know, mostly pretty, like, you know, burnout, hippie protest stuff. And here you have highly militaristic, you know, gun-toting Walter, but they are inseparable in some weird way.
Yep.
The Point Huron statement or whatever. It was like
yeah,
that,
the Port Huron statement.
The watered down first. The radical version before it got watered down.
It's a joke my parents really like.
I was going to say, I don't even know what those things are, but I mean,
the Port Huron statement is like the most militaristic, you know, statement, 60s statement of hippie intent, basically, but just like, you know, anti-government. I love his, he's like, yeah, man. And then I did some time in the Seattle Seven, man. It was, you know, like me and six other guys.
Yeah. Roadie for Metallica, Speed of Sound Tour.
Speed of Sound Tour, bunch of assholes. Yeah, the story behind that is that they wanted to use the Ride the Lightning Tour, which was a real tour, and Metallica refused to give permission to say the phrase Ride the Lightning Tour. And so they changed it to Speed of Sound Tour and added bunch of assholes.
You know, when I was first starting to get into Metallica a little more, I remember going like, where's that Speed of Sound album? I want to hear that one. And it doesn't exist.
Nope.
All right. So dude goes home. He's having a bath.
Listening to whale sounds, if I recall, at this point.
Correct. Yep. Smoking a roach, listening to whale sounds. We hear another voicemail from the LAPD. They found the car. Things are starting to look up a little bit. And then the Germans come in to drop a ferret in the bathtub.
Hmm.
Oh, nice marmot.
There is that money, Lobovsky. We want the money, Lobovsky.
You think we are kidding or making with the funny stuff?
These are the things you haven't dreamed of, Lobovsky.
Yeah. We believe in nothing.
We believe in nothing, Lobovsky, nothing.
And tomorrow we come back and we cut off your Johnson.
Excuse me?
I said we cut off your Johnson!
Just think about that, Lobovsky.
Hey, you wiggly penis, Lobovsky.
Maybe stomp on it and squish it. Lobovsky.
And then tomorrow they come back and cut off your Johnson. Like, again, like the like just the way this guy gets accosted in his home multiple times. People just like... You'd think he'd have more locks on his door.
Oh,
or
yeah. Wasn't the bit, too? He nails some...
That's later.
Okay.
Yeah, that's for the third one.
He nails some wood to the door, but it's the wrong way. So the door just opens up the other way.
Yeah. I mean, but it's just like... just really just funny stuff of him, you know, just being abused within his own bathroom. Nice marmot. And then this also introduces this thing about them wanting to cut his dick off. Mm-hmm. That we'll keep repeating as a running joke. All right. So we go to the impound lot. They found the car. This is the stuff about leads.
Give me leads.
Really, really funny.
Oh, man. Lodged where?
You're lucky she didn't get chopped, Mr. Lebowski.
Oh, man.
Must have been a joyride situation. They abandoned the vehicle once they hit the retaining wall.
Oh, my fucking briefcase, man. It's not here.
Yeah,
shit.
I saw that on the report. Sorry. You got to get in on the other side. The side view was found on the road by the car. You're lucky they left the tape deck, though, in the credence.
Oh, Jesus, what's that smell, man?
It's probably a vagrant slept in the car. Or maybe just used it as a toilet and moved on.
Hey, man, are you going to find these guys? Or, you know, I mean, you got any promising leads or...
Leads? Yeah, sure. I'll just check with the boys down at the crime lab. They got four more detectives working on the case. They got us working in shifts. Leads.
I love that scene. It's just like a little, again, one of these little like weird Coen Brothers-esque scenes of like a, you know, one offbeat character for one scene. There's a smell in the car because probably some homeless person slept in it. Like everything about this is like, this is another funny thing of like this movie has that thing of like the running gag of the car that gets damaged worse and worse throughout the course of the movie until it's like virtually destroyed. Like Tommy Boy does this. Like there's something about that trope that always works for me that like the iconic
planes, trains, and automobiles.
Mm-hmm. So now they're back at the bowling alley and dude is distressed. He's, you know, my only hope is that the Big Lebowski kills me before the Germans cut my dick off. So he says, fuck the tournament to Walter, who is not having any of that. He storms off and we finally see Sam Elliott in the flesh.
You got a good sarsaparilla.
Sioux City sarsaparilla.
Yeah, it's a good one. How you doing there, dude?
Not too good, man.
One of those days, huh?
Yeah.
Well, A wiser fellow than myself once said, sometimes you eat the bar and much obliged. Sometimes the bar while he eats you.
That some kind of Eastern thing?
Far from it. I like your style, dude.
Oh, well, I dig your style too, man. Got a whole cowboy thing going.
Thank you. There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the fuck are you talking about?
Okay, dude. Have it your way. Take her easy, dude.
Yeah, thanks, man.
And this is very, I mean, it might be a little bit pat to interpret this as like talking to God, but it kind of is, I feel like. And, you know, it's interesting that he has this really benevolent attitude towards Jeff, you know, Lebowski. And, and he is kind of this interesting, I do think the dude is this sort of stand-in for humanity, you know, in some weird way. You know, he's very vulnerable, you know, and lost. And here comes this figure, you know, to come in and provide him with some comfort, you know?
Hmm. I hadn't thought of it that way, but yeah.
Yeah, it's sweet. I mean, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that an Eastern thing? Something like that. Like, they are invoking religion in some way with this guy. Just sort
of. Yeah, and the stranger knows everything about him and knows, you know, do you have to use so many curse words, you know?
This is probably the first Sam Elliott thing I was aware of, too. Like, I don't think I was aware of him in much. And like, oh, okay. Even though he'd obviously had a long career before this movie.
Yeah. You know, that's another interesting L.A. thing to me is, you know, obviously not a Western town, but certainly where a lot of Westerns were produced. And there's Gower Gulch, you know, and all of those things. So it is a very L.A. thing, certainly at a certain period of time, you know, to have cowboys walking around or, you know, fake cowboys, Hollywood cowboys.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just these fun little diversions. All right, so we get a call from Maude saying, hey, you haven't gone to the doctor yet. And this is where we meet David Thewlis's character.
Knox Harrington, the video artist.
Yes.
Who's your friend with the cleft asshole?
He just kind of titters through this entire scene. And if audiences don't know who he is Professor Lupin from the Harry Potter series. Mm-hmm. He's been in a lot of things.
But he's just this weirdo, you know, in Maude's home, sitting on the couch, like thumbing through a magazine, just giggling.
So what do you do, Lebowski?
Who the fuck are you, man?
Just a friend of Maude's.
Yeah, the friend with a cleft asshole. What do you do?
Oh, nothing much.
Hello, Jeffrey.
Hello.
Yeah, how are you? Listen, Maude, I got to tender my resignation or whatever because looks like your mother really was kidnapped after all.
She most certainly was not.
Hey, man, why don't you fucking listen occasionally, you might learn something. Now, I got...
Please don't call her my mother. She's most definitely the perpetrator and not the victim.
I'm telling you, I got pretty definitive evidence.
From who?
From the main guy, Uli.
Uli Kunkel? Her co-star in the Beaver picture?
You mean vagina? I mean, you know the guy?
I might have introduced him for all I know. You remember Uli? He's a musician, used to have a group, Autobahn. Look in my LPs. They released one album in the late 70s. Their music is sort of a techno-pop. So he's pretending to be the abductor.
Well, yeah.
Look, Jeffrey, you don't really kidnap someone you're acquainted with. The whole idea is that the hostage can't be able to identify you after you've let them go.
Well, I know that. What the fuck is with this guy? Who is he?
Knox Harrington, the video artist.
you know, all the time. And yeah, he asks, you know, who's your friend with the cleft asshole? And she goes, you know, Knox Harrington, the video artist. And I just love, that's it. He's the video artist, you know, Knox Harrington. I just think,
as if that was a job.
Again, I just think I've met so many Knox Harringtons, you know, in Los Angeles. It's just like, such a perfect character.
Well, I think the dude even asks, like, what do you do? And he's like, oh, a little of this, a little of that. Like, it's that feeling of like, do you have a job? Like, what?
No one seems to have a job in this movie, by the way.
No.
Nobody. I don't think anyone does.
That's a very LA film.
Yep. No, Jackie Treehorn works for a living.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, working hard as a people. But even the Big Lebowski doesn't have a job. You know, no one seems to have a job.
Yeah.
I wonder, like, yeah, we assume Walter has a job, but we don't know what it is.
He's living on a military pension, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I figured. He's on pension, yeah.
That's possible. So Maude is, you know, actually kind of on the same wavelength as Walter because she says, yeah, I think the kidnapping is crap. The only evidence you got is, you know, nothing really. You've got Uli from Autobahn pretending to be the abductor. And so I love that. Like, I think that album cover is so funny. Like, them in all those red suits. Like, it's super 80s, like Devo.
Very Devo.
Oh, yeah. And so she says, no, you really need to go see the doctor. So he goes to the doctor and is told to take his shorts off. Which, well, again, we'll find out later is because I guess the doctor's doing something to check out his sperm. I'm not really sure. And so now we get Jeff is driving his car. He's playing his Credence, looking out my back door. But he notices that this VW bug is tailing him again, which causes him to drop his roach in his crotch. And he hits a dumpster. But this causes him to kind of look a little more closely at the car, and he finds some teenager's homework buried between the seats.
I mean, that sequence, by the way, is a very good comedy, physical comedy sequence, where he drops the roach in his lap and then pours beer on his crotch to put it out and, like, crashes. It's pretty great.
The timing of it is really good too. Like the way that whole
thing. Yeah, he's bopping to the music, yeah. You know. He's finally letting his guard down again, and then. Yeah. Ridiculous.
Yeah. So now we cut to the dance cycle, the quintet, and we see what it is the landlord has been working on.
Lives in North Hollywood on Radford near the In-N-Out Burger.
Oh, the In-N-Out Burger's on Camrose.
Near the In-N-Out Burger.
Those are good burgers, Walter.
Shut the fuck up, Donnie. The kid is in ninth grade, dude, and his father is... Are you ready for this? His father is Arthur Digby Sellers.
Who the fuck is that?
Huh?
Who the fuck is Arthur Digby Sellers?
Have you ever heard of a little show called Branded, dude?
Yeah, yes,
I know. All but one man died there at Bitter
Creek. I know the fucking show, Walter, so what?
Fucking Arthur Digby Sellers wrote 156 episodes, dude.
Huh.
Bulk of the series.
Oh.
Not exactly a lightweight.
No.
And yet his son is a fucking dunce.
Hmm.
Anyway, we'll go there after the what have you. Embrace the kid, should be a pushover.
We'll be near the In-N-Out Burger.
Shut the fuck up, Donnie. We'll go out there, we'll brace the kid, he should be a pushover. We'll get that fucking $1 million back, if he hasn't spent it already. A million fucking clams. And yes, we'll be near the
In and out.
Some burgers, some beers, a few laughs. Our fucking troubles are over, dude.
This thing is so, like, it's so perfectly weird, and like, cause he's not, you'd think this would be some kind of a ballet, but it's not. You know, he's not light on his toes enough for it to be a ballet. Like, he's just sort of, like, stomping around.
Yeah, he's in this sort of skin-colored unitard with vines.
With, like, leaves on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty good.
Awesome. I want to know more about, like... Because you have to assume they filmed a lot more than they used of this. So I want to know what else.
Yeah, that seems like a DVD extra. The full cycle, you know.
I don't need to see the full cycle. If it's a cycle, it's probably very long.
So fun little like side gag too, you know, when they're talking about where they're going or whatever. It's like, it's near the In-N-Out, you know, those are good burgers, dude, you know, like, and then they're in the car, you know, drinking sodas from In-N-Out, you know.
Yes, they will get, they eventually get their In-N-Out after the misadventure they're about to have.
Okay.
Because Walter says, he tells them, hey, we figured out, you know, we know who this kid is, this Larry Sellers, whose name is on the homework. Yeah. He is the son of famous TV writer Arthur Digby Sellers, who wrote 156 episodes of the television show Brandon, which of course doesn't exist.
Bulk of the series. In real life.
Bulk of the series, though. He wrote the bulk of the series. I mean, 156 episodes is a lot of television. That's like a show that ran for like at least seven seasons.
Yeah. A show which had deep personal significance for Walter.
Yes, apparently. Because he talks about it, like he takes that show very seriously.
Yeah.
And he also like quotes something. They have this like what sounds like a quote from like probably what would have been
the theme song.
The opening of the show.
Yeah, he does like some, yeah, or something like that, yeah.
Well, later, it's something like all but one of me had died. Like, I forget what he says. Like,
I believe the premise of the show is that this guy, you know, survived some sort of attack or something, you know, in the military. And then he's branded like a coward or something for surviving.
Oh, is it branded?
Yeah, it's branded. It's branded.
Oh, man. I spent this. I was today years old when I found that out then, because I thought it was Brandon.
No, branded. And I believe the implication is that Walter may have had some similar experience in the military. So.
Gotcha. All right. I guess that makes more sense. All right. So, but yes, they say they're going to go find this kid who stole the car and in theory has the money, and then they will go get In-N-Out.
And it should be noted here, branded is implied, I believe, to be a Western.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. Hence the name.
So they roll up to the Sellers' house where there's a conspicuously new Corvette parked outside, which they assume the kid bought with the money. And they go in to talk about Larry and interrogate little Larry. Everything about this scene is just, it's really probably one of the funniest scenes in the movie. And again, full of some of the most weird, random shit.
I mean, you show this to somebody who's not on the right wavelength and they're not going to understand, you know, anything that's happening. It's so weird.
Yes.
Well, yeah. The fact that like the dad's in an iron lung,
you know, so it's Larry, yes. It's little Larry. It's his father who's in an iron lung. And then some sort of, you know, maid or housekeeper nanny who's
Pilar.
There. Yeah. Pilar. Oh, yeah. You get the sense that Walter talked to her on the phone or something. So he already knows her name. He's like, Pilar, when they show up. And he asks her, you know, this guy's in an iron lung. And he goes, does he still write? And she's like, oh, no, he has health problems. Just in an iron lung. It's so weird. Yeah, so Larry, I don't believe, says a word.
Not one.
No, he just stares at them.
So he's this little punk kid, and they come, and, you know, they're confronting him about the missing money, I guess.
Is this your homework, Larry?
Just ask him about the car, man.
Is this yours, Larry? Is this your homework, Larry?
Is that your car out front?
Is this your homework, Larry?
We know it's his fucking homework. Where's the fucking money, you little brat?
Look, Larry, have you ever heard of Vietnam?
Oh, for
you're entering a world of pain, son. We know that this is your homework. We know that you stole a car.
And the fucking money.
And the fucking money. And we know that this is your homework.
We're going to cut your dick off, Larry.
You're killing your father, Larry. All right. This is pointless. Okay, it's time for plan B. You might want to watch out that front window, Larry. Son, this is what happens when you fuck a stranger in the ass! Language problem here. Little prick stonewalling me.
Walter! What are you doing, man? What are you doing?
Here you go, Larry. You see what happens? You see what happens, Larry? You see what happens? This is what happens when you fuck a stranger in the ass, Larry. This is what happens, Larry. You see what happens, Larry? You see what happens when you fuck a stranger in the ass? This is what happens. You see what happens, Larry? You see what happens, Larry?
And, it's, yeah, Walter goes postal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love this. The interrogation is hilarious as they try to, like, we're going to outsmart this kid. And he literally just says nothing and stares at them as they go back and forth. It's really just, you know, they try to, like, good cop, bad cop him a little bit, but they're not smart enough to pull that off.
Right.
All the stuff. You know, well, now you're entering a world of pain, you know. And yeah, then we get to, this is what happens when you fuck a stranger in the ass, as he demolishes the Corvette with a golf club. And then I love, just, it's such a great little, like, cherry on top of the scene that, like, to have this guy come out from another house and go, like, what the fuck are you doing? That's my car.
A guy who you really feel like sunk a lot of his money, you know, he probably could not afford this car, and they've just kind of trashed it.
I kill your fucking car.
I kill your car. Dylan, were you the guy that told us what the network version of the fuck a stranger in the ass? Do you guys know this?
No, I don't. No, what is it?
I don't know. This is what, so, you know, this is always this is an artifact of people our age. When you watched a movie on network television, right? People are like, what are you talking about? So for those that are, for the younger folks, you know, there used to be this thing called television. Now, so you know, they would play these movies on network TV and you can't, you know, if it's a R-rated movie, like this movie's got, I mean, this movie has like one of the records for the number of F-bombs in it. It is like every other word. And, so I don't know how the hell you do this on network TV, but somehow they managed. And, a lot of times they would take a phrase and rather than just bleep it, they would dub over an alternate line. So instead of, this is what happens when you fuck a stranger in the ass, it's, this is what happens when you find a stranger in the Alps. So, wow. One of my favorite ones is instead of Jesus Christ sometimes in movies, they would change it to, like, I think it was like the Wedding Crashers or something. It was cheese and rice.
Cheese and rice.
My favorite one was Die Hard. Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker becomes Yippee-ki-yay, Mr. Falcon.
Mr. Falcon.
Mr. Falcon. Good old Which Mr.
Falcon.
Which
makes no sense.
Yeah. So those are fun to look up. I mean, speaking of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, it's very strange if you go and look up the... Because Planes, Trains, and Automobiles gets all its F-bombs out in that one scene at the car rental, you know, with Steve Martin there. You know, I want my fucking car right fucking now. And it's a great scene, and they filmed an alternate one, they, you know, for network television where they don't do any of that, and it, the rhythm of it is so wrong, it's amazing how much it doesn't work. It's, if you want to disappoint yourself, go watch that clip. I'm sure it's on YouTube of the sanitized version. It's so strange. It's utterly bizarre.
Sounds bad.
Yeah, it's strange. Well, it's so rhythmically important, all those F-bombs in that scene, you know.
Yeah sure.
Yeah. Hmm. And I want, you know, there is a possibility that someone else is going to be far more mean and nasty when they pay little Larry Sellers a visit later, that we don't see in the movie. But there's someone might take it out on him pretty good. So we'll see.
Yeah.
All right. So they get their In-N-Out to Oye Como Va. And the dude's at home. He takes a call from Walter. He, you know, kind of had enough. While he's this is where he's nailing the board to the floor.
Okay. Yeah, with the chair.
Right. He's going to prop a chair in front of, use against this board in the floor that will hold the door closed, so no one can get in. The problem is, of course, the door opens the other way,
which I gotta believe is really rare for a home to have the door open the other way. I was just thinking about that. Like, if you have deliveries and stuff, just is in front of your. You know what I mean?
Yeah, usually you're
pretty
your
rare that the door opens outward, but I think for the purposes of comedy, you know, it's
I was gonna say that might be the only reason it does.
Yeah, but it's a great joke. And it's the Rugpiers. It's Wu and the other guy. They're back, and we find out they don't work for they're not the kidnappers, of course. They work for Jackie Treehorn. Mm-hmm. And we've been hearing about Jackie Treehorn here and there, but he is the producer of the porn, in particular Log Jammin'. And what they've been saying is, oh, Bunny owes money to this guy. And so he's been sniffing around the perimeter of the movie trying to get his money back. When I mentioned before, there were like surreal, like dreamlike things outside of the dream sequence. This is one of them where, like, it's time for you to go meet Jackie Treehorn. And the next thing we see is this topless woman like floating through the air against a black void with this really weird music playing. And then it's just like naked people
like it's not a trampoline. Like it's a bunch of people holding a big sheet of fabric and like tossing people up in the
air. These are the kinds of parties that Lost Moon Radio throws now.
Yeah, exactly. We've really graduated.
This movie is the progression of LA-based groups.
Really great introduction to like, and then like Jackie Treehorn, Ben Gazzara, like strolls out of the beach and is like, hello, like straight at the camera. Like it's very, it almost feels like it's out of a different movie, the way that's shot. It's very weird. But then he tells the dude that he's a publisher. He's got to compete with lowbrow porn, that the, you know, the brain is the biggest erogenous zone. He's working on porn software and he wants to know, where's Bunny?
Quite a pad you got here, man. Completely unspoiled.
What's your drink, dude?
White Russian, thanks.
White Russian.
How's the smut business, Jackie?
I wouldn't know, dude. I deal in publishing, entertainment, political advocacy.
Which one's log jamming?
Yes, regrettably, it's true. Standards have fallen in adult entertainment. It's video, dude. Now that we're competing with those amateurs, we can't afford to invest in little extras like story, production value, feelings. Now, people forget that the brain is the biggest erogenous zone.
Come on, you maybe.
Of course, you have to take the good with the bad. New technology permits us to do very exciting things in interactive, erotic software. Wave of the future, dude. 100% electronic.
Well, I still jerk off manually.
Of course you do. Well, I can see you're anxious for me to get to the point. Well, here it is, dude. Where's Bunny?
Well, I thought you might know that, man.
Why would I? She only ran off to get away from that rather sizable debt to me.
Well, she didn't run off. She's been,
I've heard that kidnapping story, so save it. I know you're mixed up in all this, dude. And I don't care what you're trying to get from the husband. That's your business. All I'm saying is, I want mine.
I love this moment where it's like, the dude like zeroes in on like, oh, Jackie Treehorn took a phone call. He's writing something on this pad of paper. And as soon as Jackie Treehorn walks out of the room, the dude's like, I'm going to do something smart. And he like,
yeah, it's an old PI trick. You rub the pencil on the second piece of paper to see the indentation of what had been written before.
Right. And it's just a doodle of a guy with a huge penis.
It's so good.
He takes it. He does take it. It's like, it's in his pocket. As if it's a clue. But like, I just like that they're like, they give him a chance to like, oh, we're going to do something smart. And I love the way he like, when Treehorn's coming back and he has to like get back all the way over to the couch and resume the position he was in before. Like he sort of freezes at the last second as he sits on the couch in that position. It's like, it almost feels like they used some sort of film trick to make it. He like just stops on a dime the second he gets to the spot.
Mm.
Yet another like weird character too in Jackie Treehorn. Like you bring in Ben Gazzara just to be this like sort of stand in for Hugh Hefner.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. So he gets drugged.
Great shot too, where his head hits that glass table.
Oh my God. Yeah. That looks painful. The only thing I can assume is that he put his face on the table
and did it in reverse. Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Probably the only way to do that safely.
Yeah. That's Dark also shot in that famed John Lautner house. It's in so many movies. Mm. It's actually in Beverly Hills, but they say it's in Malibu for the movie.
Can you think? I wasn't aware that there was a specific like famous shooting location. It's a nice looking house.
Yeah, it's in a number of movies. It's a very it's John Lautner's most famous piece. It's a Sheets Goldstein mansion. That's what it's called. It's in Beverly Hills, they claim it's in Charlie's Angels. It's in Big Lebowski, Bandits, Southland. Just look at Snowfall on FX. Bunch of movies.
All right, so there you go. There's your fun fact about Jackie Treehorn's house.
Yeah.
But yes, darkness
and the Big Lebowski himself's house is very close nearby. That's in at the Greystone Mansion, which is a public park in Beverly Hills. I've performed music there.
Well, that must have been fun. I mean, I assume that was after you saw this movie. So.
Yeah, I definitely didn't see the. Well, definitely was not in a wedding band when I was in, you know, high school and first saw this movie.
So did you know, like, when you were there, like, oh, I'm at the Big Lebowski's house?
No, because the party was. Oh, I knew it was the same place. They filmed a lot at the Greystone Mansion, but we were not in the rooms where Lebowski himself had had his quarters. Unfortunately.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So now we go into kind of the biggest dream sequence of the movie, which is this Busby Berkeley musical number set to Kenny Rogers' What Condition My Condition Was In.
Mm-hmm.
And man, just like, again, like the balls to just go like, let's just do a musical number in the middle of this movie.
Yeah.
I know one like weird story, which is that Jeff Bridges brought his, I think, daughter to the set. And it was like the day he, because she wanted to just, you know, see daddy at work, but it was the day they were filming this. And so his daughter watched him do all these like, you know, dolly shots of him, like sliding on his back, looking up girls' skirts.
Dresses. Yeah.
It's like, picked the wrong day to bring her to
sex. Fun fact, this is an LA thing.
Look up girls' dresses.
I would look up girls' dresses. I don't know how many daughters he has, but I was in grade school, a very small class of about 30 kids with Isabel Bridges, which is one of his daughters, I think. So if it's the same one, then I was in school with her. In fact, that's, I remember cool. We went on a field trip once and Jeff came. You know, the parents sometimes, you know, were supposed to come and kind of like keep track of the kids, you know, and things like that. And, you know, I was very young. I don't know, this could have been sixth grade, something like that. And I was just like, oh, a guy from Tron.
Right.
Yeah, at that point, you know, but I think all the parents were like, this is amazing. This is so cool, you know. But to me, I was just like, oh, so there you go. Isabel.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's lots of fun little like weird details in this. The like Valkyrie outfit that they put Julianne Moore in, that's like sort of got made of like bowling pins and stuff. Like
yeah, like, and he's dressed like the guy from Log Jammin'. He's dressed
He's wearing
guy.
The Carl Hungus outfit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome stuff. And then it ends though, like after the kind of the climax of the song, like it like turns dark where he's being chased by Autobahn with giant scissors to cut off his dick, which this is really well shot. Like this transition to him, like what he's actually doing, he's just running down the road, probably.
Oh,
yeah.
As the drugs wear off, because he was drugged by Jackie Treehorn. Yeah.
Yep.
Right. And then he's in the back of a squad car singing what is, I guess, the theme song to Branded. And now he's told to get the fuck out of Malibu by the chief of police.
Is this your only ID?
You know my rights, man.
You don't know shit, Lebowski.
I want a fucking lawyer, man. I want Bill Kunstler, man, or Ron Kuby.
Mr. Treehorn tells us that he had to eject you from his garden party. That you were drunk and abusive.
Mr. Treehorn treats objects like women, man.
Mr. Treehorn draws a lot of water in this town. You don't draw shit, Lebowski. Now, we got a nice, quiet little beach community here, and I aim to keep it nice and quiet. So let me make something plain. I don't like you sucking around bothering our citizens, Lebowski. I don't like your jerk-off name. I don't like your jerk-off face. I don't like your jerk-off behavior. And I don't like you, jerk-off. Do I make myself clear?
I'm sorry, I wasn't listening.
Ow! Fucking fascist! Stay out of Malibu, Lebowski! Ow! Stay out of Malibu, deadbeat! Keep your ugly fucking gold bricking ass out of my beach community.
Which, was it my beachside community, my peaceful?
Quiet beach community.
My quiet beach community, yeah.
Yep.
Ow, fascist!
Yeah.
Jackie Treehorn treats objects like women.
Yeah, but that looked pretty painful when, like, the
mug?
The mug to the dome. Like, God, that looks real.
He gets hit in the head a lot in this movie.
I mean, Barry, I have to assume that they... Yeah, classic noir stuff that the detective gets the shit beaten out of him for snooping around where he's not supposed to be.
Also, but, yeah, the hostile police, you know, very film noir.
Yeah.
And then that, like, this guy is so odious that he needs to stay out of the entire city of Malibu. Yeah.
This is the class warfare in this movie, you know, between the burnouts and the establishment. That comes up a lot. Yep.
Definitely. Well, yeah, the bum's lost, right? They definitely want to draw that. But then, of course, as we'll see, Jeffrey Lebowski is also a bum in his own right.
Yeah.
So the dude takes a cab ride home. He gets kicked out of the cab for denigrating the Eagles.
So weird. And,
yeah, it's very weird. Just another funny moment, but then it's punctuated by this shot of Bunny driving a convertible and a shot of all 10 of her toes.
Yep.
So Walter was right. This is our first inkling that, you know, there really is something to this notion that she kidnapped herself. And now the dude comes home to trip over that beam that he nailed in the floor.
Perfect.
And to find Maude waiting for him, and they
Lebowski.
She disrobes.
Love me.
You know, this is a very complicated case, Maude. A lot of ins, a lot of outs. You know, fortunately, I'm adhering to a pretty strict drug regimen to keep my mind, you know, limber, and I'm very fucking close to your father's money.
I keep telling you, it's the foundation's money. Father doesn't have any.
What are you talking about? He's fucking loaded.
No, the wealth was all Mother's.
Oh, he runs stuff.
Did let him run one of the companies briefly, but he didn't do very well at it.
Oh, he's,
No, he helps administer the charities now, and I give him a reasonable allowance. He has no money of his own. I know how he likes to present himself. Father's weakness is vanity, hence the slut.
Do you think he, was that yoga?
It increases the chances of conception.
Increases?
Well, yes. What did you think this was all about? Fun and games? I want a child.
Okay, yeah. Okay, but let me explain something about the dude.
Look, Jeffrey, I don't want a partner. In fact, I don't want the father to be someone I have to see socially or who have any interest in raising the child himself.
Oh, so that doctor,
Exactly.
She's so matter-of-fact about everything she says. It's really neat.
Some men have difficulty saying it. Vagina.
Like, it's incredible. Like, you've heard us quote this movie, you know, infinitum throughout this. And, like, there's something about the quotability of this movie. And I can't put my finger on, like, is it just every single thing in this is so memorable? Like, it's the cadence of the Coen brothers writing. Like, but this one more so, I think, than any other Coen brothers movie I can think of.
Did we skip over the John Polito scene? Or does that happen later?
No, that's coming. That's coming.
The order of events in this movie has just left me completely at a loss.
That's why I take notes. So we are post-coitus, and this is where the dude starts talking about his backstory to the extent that he has one. Again, the Port Huron statement.
Yeah. And she's doing exercises to increase the chances of conception.
Correct. Yes, which is a real thing. You know, Amy did some of that when we were trying to conceive. So,
did you do a spit take?
I did not. I knew what she was doing, but I knew what she was doing because I had seen it in this movie. So there you go. But then she says the money is not Lebowski's money. It's the foundation's money. And that is the clue. Because she says the Big Lebowski actually has no money. Mom holds all the purse strings. We let him just sort of, you know, feel like he's important. And that's where the dude finally says, I've been keeping my mind limber with a strict drug regimen, but that's this is the aha moment.
Yeah.
And he calls Walter. It's an emergency, and Walter doesn't want to go anywhere because it is Shabbos and he can't drive. So this is a problem, but this is where he leaves his apartment and runs into the VW bug, and he yanks out its driver, who is John Polito, and his character's name is Delfino, I think.
Who the fuck are you, man?
Relax, man. No physical harm intended.
Who the fuck are you? Why are you following me around? Relax,
come on, fuckhead!
Relax, man. I'm a Brother Seamus.
Brother Seamus? Like an Irish monk?
What the fuck are you talking about? My name is Delfino. I'm a private snoop like you, man.
What?
A dick, man. And let me tell you something. I dig your work. Playing one side against the other in bed with everybody is fabulous stuff, man.
I'm not... Fuck it, man. Just stay away from my fucking lady friend.
Hey, I'm not messing with your special lady.
She's not my special lady. She's my fucking lady friend. I'm just helping her conceive, man.
Hey, man, I'm not...
Who are you working for? Lebowski? Jackie Treehorn?
The Knutsons.
Who the fuck are the Knutsons?
The Knutsons. It's a wandering daughter job. Bonnie Lebowski, man. Her real name is Fawn Knutson. Her parents want her back. See?
Jesus fucking Christ.
Crazy, huh? Ran away about a year ago, and the Knutsons told me I should show her this when I found her. It's the family farm. It's outside of Moorhead, Minnesota. They think it'll make her homesick.
Oh, boy. How you going to keep them down on the farm once they've seen Carl Hungus?
A Brother Seamus.
Oh, like an Irish monk?
This is where we get like a whole bunch of like meta discussion of the movie from this private eye telling him, oh, you know, I love your style. I dig your private eye mojo, basically. Yeah.
The visuals are also lifted right out of The Big Sleep. If you watch The Big Sleep and this back to back, it's like the same scene.
Yeah, this is just such a, again, like stuff that goes nowhere mostly, right? Like you had this bug show up two other times in this movie. Mm-hmm. That is tailing him. And we find the reason he's actually tailing him is because he was hired by Bunny's parents to try and find her. It's a lost daughter gig. But how are you going to keep him down on the farm once you've seen Carl Hungus?
That's right.
Yeah. What's her real name is Fawn Knudsen. I have in my notes. That's her real name.
Right. Oh, God, I forgot that.
Yeah, I it's interesting. Like, I think this could have also been the clue that broke things open if they hadn't had Maud say what she said. Like, you could this would have been probably enough to go like, oh, okay. But I like this. And we get this quick shot of Autobahn ordering Lincolnberry pancakes with their girlfriend, who's Amy Mann.
Is the waitress? She's the girlfriend. Oh, that's funny. No, it's Amy Mann. That's weird.
Yeah, it's Amy Mann, the girlfriend who gives up a toe. Yeah,
that's interesting
part. So that kind of squares that circle that it was her toe. That again, they figured that was that would convince them that Bunny was worth paying $1 million to save her life. So,
yeah.
And now we get the scene of Walter has been convinced that it's enough of an emergency on Shabbos to pick up the dude, and the dude lays out the whole plot. He says, "You know, here's what really happened. Why would they entrust me, a colossal fuck up who they just met, to save this woman's life?" And the answer is, you know, he didn't want her back. You know, he didn't care what happened to her. We threw out a ringer for a ringer.
I mean, we totally fucked it up, man. We fucked up his payoff. We got the kidnappers all pissed off at us. And Lebowski, you know, he yelled at me a lot, but he didn't do anything, huh?
Well, sometimes it's a cathartic...
No, I'm saying that if he knows I'm a fuck-up, why does he leave me in charge of getting his wife back? Because he doesn't fucking want her back, man. He's had enough. He no longer digs her. It's all a show. Okay, but then why doesn't he give a shit about his $1 million? I mean, he knows we never handed off his briefcase, but he never asked for it back. The $1 million was never in the briefcase. The briefcase was fucking empty, man. The asshole was hoping that they would kill her. You threw out a ringer for a ringer.
Okay, but how does all this add up to an emergency?
Huh?
I'm saying I see what you're getting at, dude. He kept the money. My point is, here we are. It's Shabbos, the Sabbath, which I'm allowed to break only if it's a matter of life or death.
Will you come off it, Walter? You're not even fucking Jewish, man.
What the fuck are you talking about?
You're fucking Polish Catholic.
What the fuck are you talking about? I converted when I married Cynthia. Yeah. Come on, dude.
Yeah.
You know this.
Yeah, and 5 fucking years ago, you were divorced.
So what are you saying? When you get divorced, you turn in your library card, you get a new license, you stop being Jewish?
This is the drawing room.
Jewish is fucking tub, yo.
Man, you know, it's all a part of your sick Cynthia thing. Man, taking care of her fucking dog, going to her fucking synagogue. You're living in the fucking past.
3,000 years of beautiful tradition from Moses to Sandy Koufax. You're goddamn right I'm living in the fucking past.
The Big Lebowski just kept the money for himself the whole time, which, you know, it's a great. I love the reveal on this. I love kind of the musical cue they use behind this. Mm-hmm. All the musical cues in this movie are really spot on, as is typical for the Coen brothers.
Yeah.
Correct.
All right.
Affirmative.
This is where we get the stuff about Walter's Judaism being he was a convert for his wife. Mm. But he says he's Jewish as fucking Tevye. Tevye, of course, the protagonist of The Fiddler on the Roof. So they get back to the Big Lebowski's mansion, and Bonnie's car has just crashed into a fountain, and she's prancing around, just dancing in the fountain. And this is where they confront the Big Lebowski.
I feel like I've been there. I feel like I've been in that situation.
Which part?
I feel like I've had romantic experiences like this. Oh, you're back.
Yeah, I love this. Like, I guess the nihilist knew where she was. She never even kidnapped herself. All this stuff. So they lay it all out to the Big Lebowski. And I like that the movie doesn't actually definitively state what happened, because the Big Lebowski just says, "Hey, you have your story. I have mine. I say right. I gave you $1 million and you fucked it up."
Yeah.
And maybe Larry Sellers still has it. And certainly Jackie Treehorn thinks Larry Sellers has it. So he's going to go fuck that kid up.
Yep.
To get it. And then Walter believes that the Big Lebowski is faking something else. Which
I've seen a lot of spinals in my day. This guy walks.
You just met me, you human paraquat. You figured, oh, here's a loser, you know, a deadbeat, somebody the square community won't give a shit about.
Well, aren't you?
Well, yeah, but you
get out, both of you.
Look at that fucking phony dude pretending to be a fucking millionaire.
Out of this house now, you bums!
Let me tell you something else. I've seen a lot of spinals, dude. And this guy's a fake. A fucking Goldberger.
Stay away from me, mister!
This guy fucking walks. I've never been more certain of anything in my life.
You stay away from me!
Walter, for Christ's sake, man, he's a cripple!
Come on!
Put him down, man!
Yeah, I'll put him down, dude!
Come on, man, help me put him back in his chair.
Never been more sure of anything in my life.
I like that they take the piss out of him this way, which is like, now that we've confirmed that actually that Walter was right all along, we're gonna make him wrong one more time.
Yep. Well, I remember seeing this. It came out the year after Austin Powers, when they have the "Your Mom's a Man" scene, where he's just certain that Basil Exposition's mother is a man, tries to rip off her wig.
No, that's right.
Very similar to him ripping him out of the wheelchair.
He's a man, baby.
Yeah. So they toss him to the ground. He just sits there and cries, and they walk off. So Donnie bowls a strike almost. Portend of what's about to happen to him. We get one more shot with the Jesus, where John Turturro does this pelvic thrust that, like, I don't know how he does that.
Mm-hmm.
Like the fit, like he's like made of rubber when he does this. It's very just great bit of physical comedy.
Yeah.
But we go out to the parking lot. And now the dude's car is on fire. This is the end of the dude's car at last.
They finally did it. They killed my car.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. And the nihilists are there to, you know, complain that they, you know, they want the money. And I love that they're like, you're so, there's two steps behind of the movie. I'm like, no, dude, there was no money. That was the whole point. Really, really great.
Yep.
And now we get a fight. And there's some really great physical bits in here. There's the bowling ball to the torso. Like the Walter just biting Peter Stormare's ears off. We didn't even mention one of the Autobahn guys is Flea from Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Amy Mann is in it too.
Yeah. We mentioned Amy Mann. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so weird. Yeah. Like you could have gotten anybody, but no, we want Flea for this. This is
sometimes actor Flea.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes actor Flea. He's also in Back to the Future.
Back to the Future 2, right? Is it
2 and 3, yeah. Yeah, so and then Donnie has a heart attack for no obvious reason.
Yeah, I feel like there's significance to this, but I don't really understand it. You know what I mean? Like, what Donnie represents in this movie, I've never really fully understood. He seems like the guy who's kind of caught in the crossfire of a lot of things, you know, in the turmoil of everything. As Dylan mentioned, yeah, there's a little foreshadowing there where he misses the strike or whatever, the spare or something. He doesn't pick it up. And he kind of reacts to that. And it's a very kind of literary thing of like, his luck has run out.
But yeah, his whole presence in the movie, it's not, you know, you could have the movie without him entirely. I mean, he's a lovable character, but he's not integral to any.
I would be curious, what like the Coen brothers would have to say about his, you know what I mean, his significance as a character.
Well, that, and they devote a lot. Now we're at the very end of the movie, basically, and they devote a lot of attention to the. I mean, we've gotten to the end of the mystery now. The whole mystery with the money and Bunny Lebowski has been solved. And now we're going to do like three more scenes about the aftermath of the death of Donnie.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it's not just that they have this in the movie, like the question, like, why did you introduce this character and why did you get, like, they must have some thought process because they're spending so much time on it.
Yeah. This eulogy that Walter does, I actually did as a, speech in an acting class in college, community college. Yeah,
cool.
Well, after they decide on the most modest receptacle.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, because the guy they wanted to sell him an urn for like $250 or something, and he's like, just because we're the bereaved doesn't mean we're saps.
Yeah,
so get a coffee can.
Yep. So they put him in a coffee can. They go down to the beach to spread the ashes, and Walter gives this wonderful eulogy that starts wonderful and then
quickly goes to Vietnam.
You took him, Lord,
like all things,
as you took so many bright flowering young men in Quezon.
Walter, this, what is
Hill 359
Vietnam, man? This is not... Come on, man.
I'm sorry, dude. Sorry.
Donnie was a good bowler and a good man. He was one of us. He was a man who loved the outdoors and bowling. And as a surfer, he explored the beaches of Southern California from La Jolla to Leo Carrillo and up to Pismo. He died as so many young men of his generation before his time. In your wisdom, Lord, you took him. As you took so many bright, flowering young men at Quezon, at Londoc, at Hill 364. These young men gave their lives. So did Donnie. Donnie, who loved bowling. And so, Theodore Donald Karabatsos, in accordance with what we think your dying wishes might well have been, we commit your final mortal remains to the bosom of the Pacific Ocean, which you loved so well. Good night, sweet prince.
shit, dude. I'm sorry. Goddamn wind. Fuck.
God damn it, Walter. You fucking asshole.
Dude, I'm sorry.
It's a fucking travesty with you, man.
Dude, I'm sorry. It was an accident.
What was that shit about Vietnam?
Dude, I'm sorry.
What the fuck? Does anything have to do with Vietnam?
Dude, I'm
what
sorry.
The fuck are you talking about?
Dude, I'm sorry.
Fucking...
Yeah, well, yeah, he gets, Donnie's ashes got all over the dude.
That's so much of what the Coen brothers and this movie, I think, in particular, are about, which is literally just like, just shit all over your face. Which is like, you know, you try to do something and you end up with just, you know, again, it's a fiasco. It's another Coen brothers fiasco moment. Yeah.
But it's sweet. Walter gives him a big hug and he kind of reluctantly returns it.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have their kind of final like reconciliation, followed by "fuck it, dude, let's go bowling," and then we have this rendition of "Dead Flowers," the Rolling Stones' "Dead Flowers," as performed by I think Gus Van Sant is the singer. I like this version a lot better than the Rolling Stones version, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And we get kind of our last like kind of bowling ballet stuff. Oh, we didn't even mention, speaking of bowling ballet stuff, like they took that like bit of the guy spraying it, that becomes Saddam Hussein spraying.
Yeah.
The
oh, yeah. In the dream sequence.
Or the dream sequences, yeah. Yeah, again, Gulf War One. They keep making reference to it.
Yeah. So now we get this last scene between the dude and the stranger, you know, talking about, hey, you know, that's the dude abides. You know, he finally says and walks off.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, sometimes you eat the bar and sometimes, you know. Hey, man.
How do you do, dude?
I wondered if I'd see you again.
I wouldn't miss the semis. How things been going?
Oh, you know, strikes and gutters, ups and downs.
Sure, I got you.
Yeah. Thanks, Gary. Well, take care, man. Gotta get back.
Sure. Take it easy, dude.
Oh, yeah.
I know that you will.
Yeah, well, the dude abides.
The dude abides. I don't know about you, but I take comfort in that. It's good knowing he's out there, the dude, taking her easy for all us sinners. Shush. I sure hope he makes the finals. Well, that about does her. Wraps are all up. Things seem to have worked out pretty good for the dude and Walter. And it was a pretty good story, don't you think? Made me laugh to beat the band. Parts, anyway.
And then dude abides. I don't know about you, but I take great comfort in that.
Yeah,
knowing that he's out there taking her easy for all us sinners.
Yeah, he tries to like throw more weight and importance into the movie than it has. it's great. Like even he says, like, yeah, it made me laugh to beat the band. Parts anyway.
Parts anyway.
Yeah, I don't know what the deal was with Donnie dying. That was sad.
Yeah, it was sad.
You know, like,
but I didn't like how
Donnie died.
Yeah. There's a little Lebowski.
Giving this story, though, a narrator, you know, it makes it all the more the L.A. fairy tale that we've already been saying.
Yeah, it's very much a fairy tale. But it's, you know, yeah, again, just that warmth and that benevolence towards this guy who is inconsequential, you know, in every other aspect, but he's got this force that's looking out for him. And that is what religion is for so many people. You know, it's like that there's something out there looking out for you.
Mm-hmm. Well, so this is we're at the end of the movie, and this movie has had such a weird like longevity, because you talk about religion, like there are like churches of dudeism, you know, where people will, you know, supposedly practice the philosophy of the dude. There's books written about the philosophy of the dude. Sure. There's the Lebowski Fest that now happens every year that people, you know, come to and dress up like the dude and the other characters. Like, this thing has really taken on a life of its own.
At least it's an ethos.
Yeah. I mean, why do you think it is that this thing is like that? It does in fact abide.
Why do you think it endures, I think, is what Doug is asking.
Yeah. Why? I mean, this thing has a crazy weird fandom in addition to, you know, it's just well regarded as a movie.
Yeah, why is that? I think it's one of the arguably the smartest Coen Brothers movie. I think that it just really it rewards people who are sort of looking beneath the surface and in sort of making use of their own intellect to get these little subtle reference points and callback jokes. And I think it endures because it's their smartest work.
Dan?
I agree with that. I think that this movie is, you know, it's one of those, they don't make them like they used to. They've never made them like this. I mean, for one thing, but they certainly don't make things like this anymore. So it's, you know, it's an original piece. It's not a reference to, well, it's a reference to other things, but it's not like a franchise. You know, it's nostalgic. It's, so I think there's, it's got that retro kind of quality that younger people, I think, like about it. It's a simpler character in a simpler time. So that's got kind of that positive glow about it. You know, I think these are all things that sort of make it a comforting movie to watch in a weird way. You know, once you're on board, it's like comfort food, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's all of those things. I think, you know, it is incredibly funny. Even on rewatch, like I think it's, as you said, it kind of gets funnier on rewatch the more you notice.
You're anticipating things now, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, as you said, like so much of the fun of this movie is just quoting all of these memorable moments in it. And to the extent that there is some sort of deeper meaning to the movie, it is a lot of basically, fuck it, let's go bowling, right? Yeah. That our world is confusing. There are things full of these tangents that go nowhere. We are all often like children that have wandered into a movie theater in the middle and are out of our element. And you know, I think we can all, we're not all burnouts like the dude, but we can really empathize with the guy who is dealing with stuff that is way beyond his, you know, ability to comprehend. You know, he's in so far over his head and nothing he does goes right for him for the most part. And there's just something about the idea of like going against all of the insanity of the world. If all you can really do is say, fuck it, let's go bowling, that's actually not too bad.
Yeah.
So
I like that.
Yeah, I'm really glad we got a chance to revisit this one. There's so many just fun little moments that like, and well, obviously by now you've heard all the little clips I've dropped in, but like go watch this movie, you know, a bunch of times to really do that kind of deep dive into it, that kind of, you know, strip mining of all the comedy that's there, because there is so much extra stuff.
It's a dense work. I mean, like all good works of art, you can observe it differently at different times in your life from different perspectives. Like I've never watched it and not noticed something else.
And yet at the same time, there is, as you've said, Dan, like sort of this comfort food quality to it. You it's also the movie you don't have to watch, you know, you can semi have it on the background if you want. And that's fine too, because it's got, you know, it's got fun stakes, but it's not a stressful movie to watch. You could just, you know, it's purely fun, even though there is a mystery and to it. So it really rewards multiple kinds of viewing, whether it's background noise or whether it's something that you're noticing every little detail.
Much like this podcast.
Exactly. Background noise for you while you drive or work out or go to sleep. So with that, let's bring it to a close. Dylan, anything you want to plug?
Anything that I want to plug right now? On April 13th, there's going to be a new glam rock concert with Roger Wodehouse, Chelsea Telegram, our comedy glam rock band, and I predict that Dan, if he's available that night, will be making a cameo.
Okay. Yeah, well, we should talk about it. Yeah.
Yeah. This just got booked. So, anyways, big spoiler alert.
And also, if you want to book the Moon Units for a gig,
yes,
go do that.
Yes, the Moon Units. We know 550 songs and can also do live band karaoke if you.
Is this themoonunits.com?
Themoonunits.com. Weddings, corporate parties, birthday parties. We We want to party with you. Live music.
We want to party right. with you.
Dan, anything you want to plug?
No, you know, I at the end of these podcasts, I just talk about my own personal journey. So, you know, I'm continuing to right, kind of sure. focus on that, holding down a job and kind of just working through, you know, recovery from certain things. But yeah, no, I don't really have anything other than what we've been working on. And hopefully that will also change. But hopefully I've got a gig on the 13th. So
yeah. There you go. Things are looking up now. So if you have thoughts on this show, of course, you can send them to any of our social media portals, which are in the show notes. But we're on all the big social networks, so go find that stuff. And if you want to drop us a review, that would be awesome if you could. That's just go to wherever you found the podcast and put in a number of stars or some nice words. That actually goes a long way, and it only takes you a few seconds to do. So please do that. This is normally where I talk about our upcoming episodes and our recent ones, but this one might be getting recorded a little out of order. So I'm not sure on the batting order just yet. So we'll just leave it at that. I got a lot of fun stuff in the works. I just don't know what order you're going to hear it in. So guys, thanks again for coming and doing this show on The Big Lebowski, because it's one of my favorite movies. What a great excuse to rewatch it.
Mine too.
Absolutely, Doug. I just noticed that I'm staying with my parents here tonight and the frogs are out. So I really hope this audio is not... The frogs
are tainted by frogs.
Well, I'll see what I can do about it.
They had a lot. Yeah, defrog it. If not, I thought they had some interesting points to make.
I'll get a defrog third party plugin.
Yeah,
I'll just go on Audacity and just capture the frog noise and delete it out later.
Perfect.
All right. So until next time, that is one more entry in the Nostalgium Arcanum.
Someone painted April Fool in big black letters on a dead end sign. I had my foot on the gas as I left the road and blew out my mind. 8 miles out of Memphis and I got no square. 8 miles straight up downtown somewhere. I just dropped in see what condition my condition was in. I said I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah.
Here you go, Larry. You see what happens? You see what happens, Larry? You see what happens? This is what happens, Larry. You see what happens, Larry? You see what happens when you find a stranger in the Alps? This is what happens. You see what happens, Larry? You see what happens, Larry? This is what happens when you feed a soldier scrambled eggs. What happens, Larry?
Baby.
What happens when you fool a stranger?
What the hell are you doing, man? Oh, stop it!
Hey, man.
I just bought that guy last week.
Whoa.
Hey, I'm gonna kill you. Man. I just bought that guy last week.
Come on, man.
I'll kill you, Carmen.
No, hey, that's not his head.
No, man.
That is no.
Oh, no, man.